5 years on from the publication of this revolutionary English translation, I'm learning about Tyndall's legacy not only for society, but for our language too. The Deadliest Book in England. Available to hear now on BBC Sounds.
On FM, on digital, and on BBC Sounds, this is BBC Radio 4.
It's 6 o'clock on Monday, the 24th of August. Good morning, this is Today with Henry Zeffman and Justin Webb.
The headlines today. Andy Burnham is visiting Ukraine, and he's agreed to provide Kyiv with the technological know-how to produce a long-range missile. We'll hear from inside Ukraine and from a former head of MI6. The families of the two police officers killed by a car travelling on the wrong side of the road have described them as heroes. The force's police and crime commissioner is on at 7:30.
Also in today's programme, Cross Country will run a full train service today, they say, following a major disruption. But why have there been two power outages affecting our rail network in the space of 2 weeks? And Justin Rowlett's on a special mission on the trail of a very rare bird.
We've come to a top secret location. All I can say is that we're somewhere in England. I've been told not even to mention the county. If bird spotters knew where it was, they would come here, not just in their hundreds, but in their thousands.
Plus, when someone says they have detailed knowledge of something, this is what it means.
The 1940s moquette known as Roundel or Bullseye was originally attributed to Eddie Chapman, but was later discovered to be the work of which other designer?
Joy Jarvis.
It was Joy Jarvis.
We'll be talking to the mastermind contestant who's become an internet sensation for having a very niche specialist subject. The BBC News read this morning by Charles Carroll.
Andy Burnham is making his first overseas trip as Prime Minister to Ukraine, with Kyiv set to be given key blueprints to produce long-range missiles. The UK will allow the defence company MBDA to share classified information on British components for the Scalp missile, the French equivalent of the UK's Storm Shadow. The trip has been timed to coincide with the 35th anniversary of Ukraine's independence from the Soviet Union. From Kyiv, here's our Ukraine correspondent, Dan Johnson.
The Prime Minister will attend Ukraine's Independence Day celebrations and chair his first meeting of the Coalition of the Willing, the partnership of more than 35 nations backing Ukraine. He'll meet President Zelensky almost a month on from their first meeting in Portsmouth. Mr. Burnham's expected to be given an award in recognition of the UK's assistance and provision of equipment and weapons over the 4.5 years since Russia's full-scale invasion. He'll say he wants the Ukrainian people to hear directly from him that British support will not waver as long as it takes, and that Russia's threats against the UK will only strengthen that resolve. He'll announce the release of classified information enabling Ukraine to produce its own version of the Storm Shadow or Scalp long-range cruise missile, which was designed jointly with France.
The wife of Matthew Blades, one of the two police officers killed in a crash on the A66 near Middlesbrough on Saturday, has said he gave his life protecting and serving others. The family of the other officer, Tom Clough, have described him as their hero. The pair were in a police vehicle which was hit by a VW Passat travelling the wrong way along the dual carriageway. 5 young men in the Passat also died. Tom Simons reports.
The police watchdog said intelligence reports had been received about incidents involving the Volkswagen Passat. It was believed to have cloned plates. It had activated an automatic number plate camera. This led to a 7-minute pursuit, which ended, likely for safety reasons, when the car turned onto the dual carriageway. The crash happened 10 seconds later. PC Matthew Blades and PC Tom Clough, who were killed, had been tasked with searching the area for the Passat. A video posted last year on a TikTok account believed to belong to one of the occupants of the Passat, Mackay Saddington, showed him and 4 other young people involved in what appeared to be a police pursuit. BBC analysis suggests the car was being driven on footpaths and parkland in Middlesbrough, with Mackay Saddington in a rear seat.
New analysis suggests that 10% of the dental practices in England, which were offering NHS treatment in 2017, have since stopped. The research has been carried out by the independent health think tank the Nuffield Trust, which says only just over half of all practices now provide NHS care. In Devon and Cornwall, more than a quarter of NHS practices have gone. The Department of Health says it's changing the contract to make NHS dentistry more sustainable. Dr. Vivek Shah, a dentist in Northampton, says many in the profession are fed up.
We're subsidising the NHS system through our private patients, and long term, that is not sustainable. No government seems to be prepared to hold its hand up or to make real reform changes that take into account what dentists want. So I see this as a slow death.
The train operator Cross Country has said that it will run a full service today after serious disruption yesterday. A power cut in Birmingham affected a control centre, leading to cancellations on many routes. Reform UK will announce today that if the party was in government, priority for social housing in England would be given to young British-born workers, armed forces veterans and married couples with children. There are currently more than 1.3 million households on social housing waiting lists. Here's our political correspondent, Ian Watson.
After a difficult summer for Reform UK, the party is keen to seize the political initiative. As well as giving priority access to council and housing association homes to British workers under 35 and to married parents, the party says it would build 50,000 affordable homes a year without raising taxes to do so. The Conservatives accused Reform UK of making an uncosted pledge. Reform will also restate its policy of evicting non-UK nationals from social housing. Labour say this could see NHS and care workers who've been in the country for a long time lose their homes, but that the overwhelming number of families in social rented housing are UK citizens in any case. The Lib Dems described Reform UK's proposals as a cruel gimmick. Housing is likely to be a major issue at the next general election, and the dividing lines are now being very clearly drawn.
More than 90,000 people in the US state of Nevada have been told to evacuate their homes as a wildfire approaches the outskirts of the city of Reno. The blaze now covers 15,000 acres. The National Guard has been called in to help firefighters. And the UK's rarest breeding bird, the Montagu's Harrier, has successfully reared 6 chicks after building 2 nests at a secret location. Conservationists have now tagged 2 of the juvenile females in the hope of learning more about their annual migration to Africa. Our climate editor, Justin Rowlatt, has been following their fortunes.
The Montagu's Harrier is vanishingly rare here in the UK. I can't even tell you in which county they're nesting for fear the site would be overwhelmed by bird spotters. The adult harriers winter in West Africa before migrating thousands of miles to Europe to breed, nesting on the ground amongst crops. The RSPB says climate change is making this riskier as it's bringing harvests forward, increasing the chances that nests are destroyed by combine harvesters. This year, a male, known as AU, managed to breed with 2 new females, with 2 nests a short distance apart. Farmers have worked with the RSPB to protect the chicks.
And that was Justin Rowlatt reporting.
Thank you, Charles. It's 6:07, which means it's time for the weather forecast. Over to Elizabeth Rizzini at the BBC Weather Centre.
Oh, thank you very much. Well, it's going to be dry today, but it will be rather unsettled at times this week with some heavy thundery rain moving in from the south. The risk of some rain towards the south on Tuesday, particularly on Tuesday night, and then that rain is going to push further northwards as we head through Wednesday and eventually Thursday too. It's going to be really quite warm towards the south in particular, with that warmer air gradually pushing further northwards as we head through the week, and then into Friday and the weekend it will start to turn cooler again. But some muggy nights ahead at times this week as well. Let's take a look in a bit more detail at today. So quite a range of temperatures this morning. It's mild in the south, but we're seeing mid-single figures for some towards the northern half of the UK. It's dry today. High pressure still very much in charge, but we're starting to draw in more of a southeasterly wind, which means that towards eastern areas of England in particular, we're likely to see a bit more cloud through the afternoon, and there is the small chance of 1 or 2 showers for parts of East Anglia, Lincolnshire, East Yorkshire, maybe. Across the Channel Islands and southwest England, there'll be more cloud and there could be a few showers by the time we get to the end of the day. Temperature-wise, we're looking at 18 to 21 Celsius for most of us, but we could get up as high as 24, 25 degrees for Wales and parts of southern and western England too. Tonight, largely dry, feeling a bit milder, again, particularly towards some of the southern coasts.
Elizabeth, thank you for that. 6:09 is the time. Let's have our first look at the papers. The front pages of The Times and The Telegraph reporting that the Prime Minister will give Ukraine secret blueprints to produce long-range missiles. According to The Times, scalp missiles are designed for attacks on high-value targets such as hardened bunkers and key infrastructure. The Telegraph says the move could convince other Western allies to follow suit. The Guardian warns, though, that it will likely escalate tensions with Moscow at an already fraught time in UK-Russian relations.
The Sun features a picture of a smiling Princess of Wales on her way to church, with the paper saying the royal family put on a united front after the Duke and Duchess of Sussex announced that they are returning to the UK. We're all grin it together, is the headline. The Eye describes Prince Harry and Meghan's comeback as a royal reckoning, saying they will have to deal with the palace whether they like it or not.
Daily Mail leads on a warning from the head of the National Crime Agency, Graham Bigger, that it's not safe for children to go online. The paper says terrifying figures reveal up to 900 cases of suspected child sexual exploitation are flagged every day.
No more is the message from families of victims of drowning on the front of the Daily Mirror. In an open letter to the Prime Minister, they say anyone can drown, but no one should. They are calling for Andy Burnham to appoint a minister with responsibility for drowning prevention.
Thor Blimey is the cartoon, the caption in the Daily Mail, as it features pictures of the Manchester City and Norway footballer Erling Haaland, having his trademark long hair cut. The Express considers whether Haaland's new close-cropped look may have left him with food for thought after failing to score in yesterday's 2-1 victory over Bournemouth. The Daily Star's editorial has no such concern, saying he remains a cut above.
It's 6:10.
Now, Andy Burnham's arriving this morning in Ukraine. Dan Johnson, our correspondent in Kiev, is on the line with a busy schedule. Dan.
Yes, he's here to mark 35 years of Ukrainian independence. There are a lot of events planned for Independence Day, but I think this will also be about rebuilding that sort of relationship that President Zelensky enjoyed with Sir Keir Starmer and other British prime ministers, reinforcing the level of support. We know the Prime Minister is going to say that he wanted to tell the Ukrainian people in person that we will be there for you as long as it takes. He says, I'm proud of the contribution our country has made, and after all, Ukraine's security is our security. He'll say the friendship between our two countries will long outlast Russia's illegal war, and Russia should be in no doubt of our resolve. We will not back down until there is a just and lasting peace. I think the message is that despite whatever Russia does to Ukraine and whatever threats it makes against the UK, Andy Burnham wants the Ukrainians to know that he will be there for them in terms of international support, but also weapons. And he's going to announce today that he's agreed with the French to share the plans of the joint designed Scalp or Storm Shadow missile so that Ukraine can start producing them itself here in-house. That is a significant step, but its importance really is in signalling that that is possible, that international partners will accept that, that the Ukrainians are capable of taking it on so that they can adopt and bring in-house production lines for even more weaponry.
But you were telling us at the end of last week, Dan, that it's not just the long-range weaponry and the offensive capability that Ukraine desperately needs at the moment. In fact, rather more, isn't it? It's the defensive abilities, which it just doesn't have, or at least is in very short supply.
Absolutely, yeah. It's the Patriot missile interceptors that are so key to bringing down Russian ballistic missiles. That has been the major vulnerability in Ukraine's airspace over the past few months. So I'm sure the discussion on the fringes of the ceremonial events today will be about how to get Donald Trump, because he's the one who holds those plans, to agree to share that technology, those patents, with Ukraine. It's something he signalled a few months ago that he was perhaps willing to consider. Then he wrote back saying the technology shouldn't be shared lightly. It's the US that is key in agreeing to that. But even if they did, ramping up production, starting the production lines here, getting things going, would take time. The Ukrainians have been phenomenally innovative in developing and increasing their own drone capacity for defensive purposes and conducting those long-range strikes against Russia. But there are gaps in their military supply. Andy Burnham will pick up an award today on behalf of the British people for the support that the UK has shown this country. But I think the President, Volodymyr Zelensky, will be hoping to reaffirm the relationship that he started on his first meeting to Portsmouth about a month ago, to use that influence amongst the Coalition of the Willing and other nations. And there's going to be a meeting of the Coalition of the Willing chaired by Andy Burnham here today. He'll be hoping to use that influence to get the sort of supplies that are needed.
Dan Johnson in Kiev. Thank you.
It's 6:13. Tens of thousands of people have been told to evacuate their homes in the US state of Nevada as a fast-moving wildfire pushes towards the city of Reno. Ruby De La Torre has been evacuated.
Oh my God, it was pretty tough. It was horrible. Trying to get up here, trying to go to the house, you know, just trying to get stuff for me and the kids. Yeah, it was pretty
Did you actually see the fire?
We did.
What did it look like?
It was just really foggy. It just looks really bad. And it's starting to get really bad up there.
Earlier, I spoke to Lucia Starbuck, a reporter for KUNR Public Radio in Reno. She began by telling me how serious a situation this is.
The fire has definitely exploded in size. It's more than 60 square kilometers. It's burning these dry desert hills with neighborhoods at the bottom. We know some homes have been burned. We don't know the exact number yet.
But we do know that tens of thousands of people have had to evacuate their homes.
Yes, 90,000 people are under evacuation notices. About half of those are mandatory.
And the other half are?
Yeah, this yellow zone, get ready to evacuate. But they're pretty much telling people if you're in that zone, either prepare or start to leave.
And do you have a sense from your reporting in Reno today of how many people are deciding to leave?
It's hard to kind of pinpoint that number. I do know last night, the first night of the fire, 465 people utilized the big shelter that got set up by the Red Cross. And a lot of the casinos were pretty filled up with evacuees. They usually offer discounted rooms when there's fires like this. And we know that the casino hotels were pretty full.
Now, that's really interesting that you said usually, because that suggests, and I think a lot of British people won't have much of a sense of Reno or what it's like. That suggests this is not a completely unprecedented occurrence in this area.
Yeah, it's not unique at all, especially for our region, the Western United States, but definitely in the Reno, Northern Nevada area too. We just had a major fire last week that burned 9 homes. Almost some of the same people are having to evacuate. So these fires are getting more frequent and a bit more intense. And it's just really scary when they burn really close to town with highly populated areas.
And as these fires are becoming more frequent, is it affecting what it is like to live in Reno? Are people deciding to relocate elsewhere, or are they having to adapt their lives, their homes, to this possibility?
They're adapting their lives. You hope that you can get fire insurance to protect your home. You don't quite know where a fire is going to start. Last year was on the other side of town. It's become very normal. You know, you see the big smoke in town, but it's definitely not pushing people out yet.
That was Lucia Starbuck, reporter for KUNR Public Radio in Reno, Nevada.
16 minutes past six, the Chinese retailer Shein has upended fast fashion in recent years. Along the way, has become one of the companies that have come to encapsulate trade tensions between China and the US. It's laying out today its plans for what could be one of the biggest listings of company shares anywhere in the world this year. Will Bain is excited about that and has that and the rest of the business news. Morning, Will.
Morning, Justin. Morning, Henry. Yes, there's been something of a lightning rod of a company, haven't they? Whether it's been what's gone on in their supply chain or indeed their proximity perhaps to Chinese regulators. But Shein saying it's seeking its $27 billion valuation when those shares eventually go on sale in Hong Kong. That could, of course, at one point have been London, but the company shifted from apparent plans to list here or in New York under pressure from those regulators and politicians. Richard Lim is with us, chief executive of research firm Retail Economics, and Jane Foley also with us this morning. Jane, to look through the financial markets. She's the head of FX strategy at Rabobank. Morning, both. Jane, first of all, that valuation then that it's seeking, $27 billion, that's a long way down, isn't it, from when this, what has been slight odyssey really for the company, finding somewhere to list these shares, what it was hoping for when it started out. So what's been the impact on that? What do you make of that valuation?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, there were at some point private valuations of up to maybe $100 billion. So this is significantly less. And again, like you were saying, it really does show the impact of the geopolitical climate. So, for instance, we've had the US removing its exemptions, which had allowed low value Chinese imports duty free. And that really did undermine the core business model of Shein, because they used to want to ship individual items directly from China. And of course, the EU have done something similar. It's removed its own exemptions and introduced additional tariffs. And it's not just these, you know, the EU and the US. We've seen import rules tightened in various other countries, Turkey, Brazil, South Africa, for instance. And so the trading environment, the business model has really been shifting for this company.
Yeah, and coming down the track here in the UK as well, changes to what we call the de minimis threshold, the £135 threshold for those parcels where they don't pay any of those import taxes on the way in if it's under that value. Richard, does it speak kind of to this company's success a little bit, the focus that politicians have put on it?
I think it does, to an extent. I think we've seen this huge wave of disruption caused by these Chinese giants, and of course, Xi'an is one of them. But it's come with a proposition to Western markets in particular, with a proposition that's really resonated with their customers. So we know from our data, for example, we know that Chinese commerce in the UK is worth about £4.7 billion. So it's accounting for about 5% of non-food online sales already, with about 50% of UK consumers saying that they have shopped from one of these Chinese retailers. So it's coming with a proposition, it's really resonated. And from a UK retail perspective, I think the cry to government and regulation is that they're not playing on a level playing field.
Yeah, we know that some of that pressure as well that Jane was talking about, and that feeling that you're talking about there, Richard, of there not being a level playing field, looks like it's having an impact on the company's financial results. Certainly made a loss, didn't it, in July, right ahead of this announcement. Does it feel like the walls are closing in on it a little bit?
Well, I think as Jane correctly said, I think that fundamentally the business model has changed, and the investor story has fundamentally changed since 2022, when they did an investment round and it put a valuation on the company of about $100 billion. So we're in an environment, or Xi'an operating in an environment now where there's a much more complex trade environment. The US, the EU have removed their favourable de minimis exemptions. The UK looks like it's going to follow in about October 2028. And then at the same time, competition from other retailers has just become more intense. So other businesses are reacting to the impact of Xi'an and others coming into the market. And it's just making it a bit more tricky while their own costs are rising as well.
I should say that Xi'an repeatedly states, when it's asked about in particular issues around the supply chain that we've talked about, that some of those politicians have been looking at, they have zero tolerance for forced labour and requires armed contract manufacturers to only source cotton from approved regions. Jane, in stock market terms, as I mentioned right at the top, at one point London looked like an option for this company. How do you think the bosses at the London Stock Exchange will be viewing this week and the IPO going on in Hong Kong?
I think this just reflects the larger global geopolitical environment, and the same I think could be said really for New York, because at one stage that there was the possibility that New York or London could be used, but I think in the environment right now, I don't think the bosses of either stock exchange will be particularly upset with respect to this. I mean, there's been a big pushback from regulation, certainly been cited here, but I think this is more to do with the political environment. And I think listing in Hong Kong was probably the more sensible option in the end for Xi'an.
Richard, thanks as always for your time this morning. Appreciate it. Richard Lim, the chief executive of the research firm Retail Economics. Jane, shall we turn to more geopolitics, I guess, now, because over the weekend, we thought, didn't we, Friday night, US and Canada time, so Saturday morning with us, was the deadline for a new agreement to be found between the two partners to see off any more tariffs. That passed, and it sounds like, from the language from both sides through the weekend, right, that this might be about to ramp up as well, this trade disagreement.
Indeed, this is quite interesting, because like you say, it appeared as if we were nearly there, or at least the US Canada were nearly there in terms of their trade agreement, and suddenly it's off the table. Canada walks away, and one of the reasons that they walk away was Canada says that the US on the 11th hour put in extra clauses, and one of these was that the US was seeking exclusive access to Canada's critical minerals. Now again, like you said, this really plays into the broader geopolitical environment, because you might recall when we had at the start of the Trump's second presidency, we had these trade tensions with China, US. China, it turns out, had a pretty strong hand, and one of those key cards it had was access to processing of critical minerals. And the US since then has been looking for other options. Canada, it thinks, would be a good place to find these critical minerals. But Canada wants to have the ability to have trade deals on its own. It doesn't want to give the US exclusive access. So this is one of the factors that really turned this trade deal sour over the weekend.
Yeah, and Mark Carney, the Prime Minister of Canada, saying he's going to match any new US tariffs dollar for dollar. Well, Laura Jones is the president and chief executive of the Business Council of British Columbia, which she gave us her reaction to these changing tariffs.
I think that the prime minister has the support of the majority of Canadians. I think it was about 75% agreed that no deal is better than a bad deal, despite the fact that 2 out of 5 Canadians are worried about their jobs as a result of the escalating trade tensions between Canada and the U.S. But we simply can't sign on to deals that undermine our sovereignty or that put major sectors at risk of being uneconomic over time. That's not a good deal.
Jane, clearly an impact on particularly smaller and medium-sized businesses in Canada, but potentially an impact on US consumers too, right? Particularly around things like cars. We know a lot of the big American car makers are working in Canada. That was one of the sticking points here, a 50% tariff there. And all of that coming at a time where inflation in the US is under real focus and what to do with interest rates alongside it.
Yes, I mean, cars are certainly in focus there because cars during their production process have tended historically to go across the border from Canada to the US several times. So that's one complicating issue. And certainly that does bring jobs in the US into the limelight. And also, as you said, prices of goods. Now, the US inflation has been above target for quite a prolonged period of time. And there is a question about whether the new head of the Federal Reserve is really focused or is going to be able to bring prices back to target. And this is one of the reasons that the bond markets in the US have been a little bit jittery recently. That and, of course, the size of the US debt, the size of the US budget deficit. So all of these in focus.
Yeah, and all of that up for discussion at the Jackson Hole meeting of central bank governors in Wyoming a little bit later on this week too. Jane, thanks as always for your time. Jane Foley, the head of FX strategy at Rabobank there. Now, higher bills this winter mean the government should step in to provide more help for households most in need with their energy bills. That's according to the trade body Energy UK, and their chief executive Dara Vias joins us this morning. Morning.
Good morning.
So I suppose the obvious question, first of all, is why can't members, your members, do that, provide support to their customers?
So the energy suppliers already do an awful lot to help and support customers. They obviously can do more based on what they know about their customers, and that relies largely on customers telling them about what's going on in the household and circumstances, finances, those sorts of things. They do offer things like reduced price, discounted white goods, energy efficiency support, extending credit, things like that. But I think it's really important to recognise that the price cap is now 70% higher than it was in 2021. And it's projected this week to reach a 3-year high. Total energy debt and arrears in households have more than doubled. So the amount that households owe the energy companies. And it's on track to reach £7 billion
by the end
of the
year. So where is the help needed, do you think?
So right now there's a support scheme called Warm Home Discount, and it gives customers who largely means-tested benefits customers £150. It's a really important source of support for those customers, but it doesn't meet the scale or complexity of the affordability challenge we're beginning to see in this sector, and we have seen for the last few years. It's increased by about £10 in the last 10 years. And I don't need to tell you how much energy bills have gone up by in the last 10 years. So what we're proposing is that the government uses data, combining sort of income data, health data, energy consumption data, and works with the energy industry, which we have begun to do, but we want to see a bigger sense of urgency.
Dara Vias, the Chief Executive of Energy UK, thanks so much for your time. And Henry and Justin, government spokesman, did say to us that the Warm Homes Discount was cutting VAT on electricity bills and would do everything we can to shield consumers from global energy shocks.
Thanks, Will. It's 28 minutes past six, and here's Hugh Ferris with the sports news.
Test squad will meet at Lord's today under another disciplinary cloud, just days since new captain Joe Root attempted to turn over a new leaf after a series of late night incidents. Brydon Carr is due to be with them, having been selected for the second test against Pakistan. But first, his bosses at the ECB are having to investigate why the bowler was seen in handcuffs, surrounded by police officers outside a bar in Derby. It's understood he wasn't arrested and was with Durham rather than England, but Carr is the 8th centrally contracted player in 10 months to be involved in such an incident, a concerning trend for chief cricket commentator Jonathan Agnew.
You can make mistakes, you can bowl like a drain, you can miss the first ball that you face.
But you owe it to yourself, and then the second part is you owe it to your team to make sure that you are in the best possible place to do that. And I think that's part of the most disappointing parts of the ill discipline that there's been over the last few months, because you're letting your teammates down. And once you start doing that, that's a really bad place to be. If you're not disciplined off the field, you're not going to be disciplined on it.
We will speak to our cricket correspondent Stefan Schemmelt at 8:25 this morning. Lando Norris has won back-to-back Formula One races at either side of the sport's summer break. The defending world champion took the last ever Dutch Grand Prix. But with the gap to championship leader Kimi Antonelli still at 83 points, the McLaren driver isn't sure he's back in the title race.
If you say that, you're just too short-sighted for the time being. We look ahead to the end of the season and we want to make sure we're in the best place possible. And in some ways, we are short-sighted too, because we want to just look to the next race. We don't want to look any further than that. I know we really need to improve in some places. If I want to repeat that line that we still have a chance for the championship, I can't repeat that until I'm confident in it. And at the minute, we need a little bit more still.
A huge mosaic paid tribute to Kevin Keegan as the two teams that most defined his career met to start their Premier League seasons yesterday. Newcastle and Liverpool was a fitting first match for both at St James's Park, with Newcastle leading until second half stoppage time when a Liverpool penalty gave them a 2-2 draw. That late goal came after two more from Manchester City in the last 6 minutes of their game that gave them a 2-1 win over Bournemouth, neither of them coming from Erling Haaland, who, as you mentioned, is pictured in most of the papers this morning with his new, rather surprising, buzz cut. Brighton scored four goals in the first half to beat Aston Villa 4-0. We'll talk about a dramatic opening weekend to the Premier League season at 7:25 with football correspondent John Murray.
Hugh, thank you.
We good? All on board?
On BBC iPlayer.
You want someone to get murdered?
I don't want that, per se.
Ludwig's back for a brand new series.
Yes, we've done quite well, all things considered. Apart from not actually catching the baddie, of course.
Starring David Mitchell and Anna Maxwell-Martin.
Who are you?
He's famous.
I'm a crime scene consultant.
You're a crime-solving puzzle setter.
Ludwig.
Missing detectives, multiple murders, and high-ranking cover-ups.
This just gets better and better, doesn't it?
Watch on BBC iPlayer.
It's 29 minutes to 7. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Justin Webb and Henry Zeffman. And now a summary of the news from Charles Carroll.
Andy Burnham is making his first overseas trip as Prime Minister to Ukraine as the country marks 35 years of independence. He's agreed to allow a defence company to share classified information about British components for a long-range missile with Kiev so that the Ukrainian military can produce its own version. The wife of Matthew Blades, one of the two police officers killed in a crash on the A66 near Middlesbrough on Saturday, has said that he gave his life protecting and serving others. The family of the other officer, Tom Clough, have described him as their hero. The pair were in a police vehicle which was hit by a VW Passat travelling the wrong way along the dual carriageway. Five young men in the Passat also died. New analysis suggests that 10% of the dental practices in England which were offering NHS treatment in 2017 have since stopped. The research has been carried out by the independent health think tank the Nuffield Trust, which says only just over half of all practices now provide NHS care. The Department of Health says it's changing the contract to make NHS dentistry more sustainable. The train operator Cross Country has said that it will run a full service today after serious disruption yesterday. A power cut in Birmingham affected a control centre, leading to cancellations on many routes. Reform UK will announce today that priority for social housing in England would be given to British-born workers under 35, armed forces veterans and married couples with children if the party gets into government. There are currently more than 1.3 million households on social housing waiting lists. Labour has called the idea unworkable. And more than 40,000 people in the US state of Nevada have been told to evacuate their homes and a similar number urged to prepare to do so as a wildfire approaches the outskirts of the city of Reno. The blaze now covers the equivalent of 20 square miles.
Thank you for that. It is 27 minutes to 7. Part of today's visit by the Prime Minister to Kiev is going to involve a formal announcement that classified information on UK components is going to be handed over to Ukraine. Let's talk to Jonathan Beale, our defence correspondent, who's on the line. What is it exactly we are handing over, Jonathan?
Well, essentially, France has already given Ukraine the blueprints for Scalp missiles, which are the same, essentially, as Storm Shadow missiles, which, remember, the UK's already supplied to Ukraine. They've been used to hit targets, not just inside occupied territories, but also military targets inside Russia itself. And the UK is essentially following France's lead and saying that Ukraine can have the details of classified UK components used in those missiles produced by the company MBDA. It is significant. It won't be quick getting a production line up in Ukraine, and they may find it hard to get all the components they need. And it's not the weapon that Ukraine needs most at the moment, which is air defence missiles, which can take down ballistic missiles. Maybe there's a hope that by doing this, other countries will follow, give their blueprints, namely, would the US give Ukraine the blueprints for Patriot battery batteries and missiles that they need. President Trump suggested he might do that and then went back on that. But I think it is something that the UK can do. As I say, it is following France's lead. But clearly there is a hope that others might follow.
Is there also a fear that it puts us more in the crosshairs of the Russians?
Well, I think we are in the crosshairs of the Russians in the sense that, you know, the rhetoric from Moscow and indeed from the embassy here in the UK has been pretty stark about consequences, prices being paid for giving Ukraine not just these Storm Shadow missiles, but drones which can hit targets inside Russia. But it doesn't seem to have deterred Andy Burnham, who is visiting Ukraine sooner than when Keir Starmer became prime minister. And remember, he's a prime minister who's said he's going to focus on domestic policies. So I think his visit is significant. But yeah, Russia at the moment, for example, has pulled out its ambassador from London. It said that that essentially it wants Britain to force it to reconsider its support for Ukraine. But I don't think there's any sign that that's going to happen. But, you know, there are no doubt about it. Concerns of increased hybrid activity, cyber attacks, sabotage, those kinds of things as a result of Britain's, what Andy Burnham says, is 100% support for Ukraine.
Jonathan Beale, thank you.
It's 24 minutes to seven. The wife of Police Constable Matthew Blades, one of two officers killed in the crash on the A66 near Middlesbrough on Saturday, has said her husband served with courage, dedication and selflessness. Matthew Blades and his fellow PC, Tom Clough, died when a car travelling the wrong way down a dual carriageway crashed into their armed response car. Well, Philippa Goymer, reporter for BBC North East and Cumbria, is at the scene. Philippa, good morning. Tell us a bit more about what the families have had to say.
Well, we've had some really moving statements from the families. As you said, PC Blades' wife described him as a beloved husband, her best friend and the most devoted father to our two young boys. And the wife of PC Tom Clough said also that her husband was a hero and that their children would be brought up to know that he was a hero. Those were two official statements that were provided by Cleveland Police on behalf of the families of PC Matthew Blades and PC Tom Clough. With regard to the families of the men that were travelling in the Volkswagen Passat, we haven't had any official tribute from the police, but we have seen a number of social media posts from their family members. And where I am right now, which is at the police cordon at the top of the A66, there are a number of floral tributes and balloon tributes that have been left from the family and friends of the five men that were in the Volkswagen Passat that hit the car carrying PC Matthew Blades and PC Tom Clough early on Saturday morning.
Do we know any more about the circumstances of the crash this morning?
So what we know about the crash is that that Volkswagen Passat had been involved in a police pursuit a few minutes prior to the crash happening, but the pursuit had been called off just 10 seconds before the Volkswagen Passat drove the wrong way down the A66 and collided with a marked armed response vehicle that was travelling the correct way on the A66. We know that that vehicle, that police vehicle, had not been involved in the pursuit prior to the crash happening. What we don't know at the moment is what led to the police pursuit happening. We don't know what intelligence there had been around that car. We know that an ANPR camera was triggered because the car was using cloned license plates, but we don't know about the other intelligence around the events that led to the car being pursued around the area. And this area, before you get to the A66, which is a dual carriageway, it's a major artery road on Teesside. It's a residential area, and we know that they were driving at speed through the residential area before heading the wrong way down the A66 when the police chase ended.
And when will we hear anything more about the progress of the investigation?
So we're expecting to hear something later this morning on the progress of that investigation. So the Independent Office for Police Conduct are leading that investigation, as is mandatory when somebody dies after police contact. And we do expect another update from them this morning. We had one yesterday which included the detail about the timing of the end of the pursuit and the cloned license plates, but we do expect to get another one later this morning.
Right, Philippa Goymer, thank you very much, and I'm sure we'll bring you any updates that we do receive this morning if they come during this programme.
20 to 7 is the time. Now, we're being warned again today about the basic ability of large numbers of people to get to see a dentist. Dr. Sheena Tanner is the principal dentist at the Billericay Dental Care Centre in Essex.
Dentists haven't stopped wanting to treat NHS patients. I think the challenge has been making NHS dentistry sustainable enough for practices to continue providing it. But it is encouraging that the government is looking into it, and the changes were made in April and again in June. But I think it's too early to tell you whether those changes have had the impact we want. Across the country, demand is enormous. You know, patients want NHS appointments, and I should say, I think practices do want to provide them, but there's only so much capacity that each practice is allowed.
Let's talk to Hugh Pym, our health editor. And this latest research, Hugh, comes from the Nuffield Trust, the think tank, doesn't it?
Yes, that's right, Justin. There's been a lot of talk about dental deserts, patients reporting they just can't find an NHS dentist or having to travel a very, very long way. And this report by Nuffield Trust looks at the actual number of practices in England providing NHS care, and they found that 1 in 10 have stopped doing that since 2017. There are around 5,600 practices now in England which work under the main NHS contract. That's down 600. And there have been particularly sharp drops in the southwest and east of England, and only one area out of 42, an area of London, actually showed an increase. Now, the authors say this is really creating a two-tier service, depending on where you live and whether you can afford to pay. And the British Dental Association, representing dentists, is calling for a major reform of the NHS contract, saying it just isn't worth their while continuing to offer NHS care. You heard there a dentist saying that some moves this year had been welcome, but I think it needs major reform, and dentists are warning, the BDA are warning, that people will continue leaving. I should just say the government line is that they are trying to make dentistry sustainable.
I was going to say on that, we've got major reform, haven't we? I mean, they've said all sorts of things about really quite large-scale changes. So, for instance, I'm just supposing away the most important one, newly qualified dentists are going to have to practice in the NHS for a minimum period of at least 3 years, and they say that's going to mean more dentists, more appointments, better oral health. What more are they expected to do?
Well, I think the dentistry sector, the dentists are saying that they've been promised major reform by successive governments, and this one certainly has promised a large scale of looking at the whole contract and starting the whole thing again. I think, yes, there's this issue of training more dentists, which has been announced, and making dentists work for 3 years after qualifying in the NHS, and changing some of the way the money is allocated. But one dentist I spoke to said actually making people do something like that might put them off in the first place actually staying any longer than the 3 years which they'd be required to work. It might might backfire. So I think there's been a lot of talk about this. Obviously, the government are aware that changes are needed, but dentists say without further money and a further genuine set of detailed proposals, this decline will continue.
Hugh Pym, thank you.
It's 17 minutes to 7.
One power outage and a whole train company seems to grind to a halt. It happened yesterday to Cross Country. power outage in its control centre meant that many of the systems used to manage the railway apparently weren't working. These passengers at Birmingham New Street were among those who faced the disruption.
There's no trains running from this station to Cheltenham, so I now have to go to another train station.
And now I'm supposed to get on the train to Bristol and all the trains are cancelled except for one. And then it's changes, loads of changes to get to Bristol. And then all the trains until like 5 or 7 are cancelled as well.
Let's talk to Anna-Jane Hunter, who's a rail consultant, former director of the North for Network Rail up until 2020. Morning to you.
Good morning.
Is it any clearer to you what actually happened?
It's not yet. My understanding from speaking to colleagues closer to the action is that there's, as you'd imagine, an investigation going on as to quite how this was able to come to pass yesterday. So the details, the exact details, are not yet clear.
But it seems to be different from the other outage. So we had that outage, didn't we, quite recently, the beginning of the month, where Network Rail's operations centre at Manchester lost power supply, and that meant that signals didn't work, etc. Is this separate from that? I mean, a separate sort of incident?
Yeah, it's really quite a different set of circumstances that we're working with here. So the incident in Manchester concerned a large purpose-built railway operating centre where systems, as you mentioned, such as signalling and others are contained. This control centre that Cross Country have is really very different. It's much smaller. It's not in a purpose-built railway building. It's right in the centre of Birmingham in an office building, essentially, that they have their control in. So really very different. And as I understand it, it was a power outage that affected quite a large area of the centre of Birmingham.
What's the wider picture? Because a lot of people will look at these two outages and say, yes, they were separate things, but they all point to the same thing, which is that our rail network is under quite a lot of strain.
Well, I'm not sure they do necessarily point to that, though I believe it is under strain for various reasons. I think just as much as that, these two incidents point to our power network being under a lot of strain. And how has it come to pass that two major power outages have happened in such a small space of time? So I think there are ongoing investigations as to how. And clearly the railway needs to respond and be resilient to when such incidents do occur. And that will be forming part of the post-incident.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. So we're presumably with better backup systems in place in the longer term.
Yeah, and my understanding is that there were backup systems, but for whatever reason, they weren't sufficient, or they didn't respond how we would have liked them to have done and how we needed them to do. But they did respond as a business quickly. As I understand it, trains were back up and running by 6 o'clock last night. And I hope they're running today. I'm told they are, and I shall be using them later to go on my holidays. Well, so hopefully they are.
Well, good luck with that. What Heidi Alexander has said, the Transport Secretary, we're setting up Great British Railways and nationalising services, including Cross Country, next year to end decades of fragmentation and vulnerability on our network. Is she right to be sort of linking all of this somehow to private ownership, as if it's going to change when they're publicly owned?
I'm not sure that's always the thing to point to, and I think as a system we don't always point to that as the reason that things have gone wrong. But I think working closer together and having less fragmentation can only be a good thing. It enables us to work hopefully more quickly and in a more joined up fashion when issues do occur. But the railway is vulnerable to external issues, and this is another example of that, where the power network is not within the gift of whatever structure the railway chooses to operate under. So it needs to be able to react to those external things as well as those that we are more in charge of.
Anna-Jane Hunter, rail consultant, thank you very much.
At 13 minutes to 7, 5 years after the Taliban swept back to power, the BBC has been reporting from Afghanistan, and especially on the conditions faced there by women and girls. Today we have a report from our colleagues at the BBC World Service, who've been given rare access to the Islamists who are now in charge. The BBC's Karoon Kamoush has spent time with senior figures, former insurgents turned politicians, to see how they are governing a country in crisis. We've also spoken to Afghans living once again under the same hardline rule the group first imposed decades ago.
In Shibrghan, northern Afghanistan, Taliban governor Abdullah Sarhadi starts his day. Once a Guantanamo Bay detainee, Sarhadi now works for the country's supreme leader, enforcing strict Sharia in his region.
Assalamu alaikum.
The BBC has been given rare access to his office to film some of his daily work, as he meets local people who come to him seeking resolutions to various problems. One case dominates the day, however. That of an 18-year-old woman who is seeking a divorce from her husband, accusing him of abuse and beatings. She is wearing a full veil and sunglasses. Her clasped hands and black gloves. To protect her identity, we have had someone else voice her words.
I'm ready to be executed, but not live with him.
The governor tells her she should either continue the marriage or apply for a khala, a form of divorce initiated by the wife, which could mean having to repay her dowry to her husband. Under the Taliban, it is very difficult for a woman to get a divorce without the husband's consent. Despite this, she wants to proceed.
Ask yourself, who would marry me after I get my divorce? You'll have to compromise a lot, or you'll lose your dignity and honor.
Mr. Governor, my honor and dignity have already been ruined by him.
Dismissing her to the next room, the governor discusses the matter with male officials, bodyguards, and her husband.
Women are mindless. They are deficient in intellect. They don't know a thing. What would you do with a divorced daughter? You can't kill her. You need to marry her with someone else. Would you marry such a girl with your son?
The woman's father says they will continue to fight for the separation. The Taliban's policies today are similar to the hardline interpretation of Islamic religious law they imposed in the 1990s, and those who oppose them have gone into hiding, especially women who have been erased from public life. When they do fight back, they face harsh crackdowns. In the week the Taliban came to power, many women took to the streets to protest. Huda had a successful career and an active life. But now we meet in secret. We have changed her name and voice to protect her safety. Why do you think the Taliban want to restrict women? I ask her.
I think the Taliban are scared. They are scared of educated women. They know educated women won't give birth to ignorant beings such as the Taliban. They restrict women so they wouldn't be able to raise wise men, because that would be the end of the Taliban.
Upon returning to power, the Taliban said they had changed. 5 years on, it's a country run by men for men. In a lavish press center funded by the Americans for the previous government, we sit down with the public face of the Taliban, their spokesman known as Zabihullah Mujahid.
And you promised that you will respect human rights, you will allow women to participate in all aspects of life, work and study. Why did you fail to keep your promise?
I mentioned Sharia as a condition. We are committed to women's rights, freedom of speech, and other things within Sharia. We must scale everything up according to Sharia.
As an insurgency, the Taliban proved they could survive. The question now is whether they can govern a country in crisis, and for how long.
That was Kawun Kamush reporting in Afghanistan. At 8 minutes to seven, you might still, however many years on, have recurring dreams, nightmares perhaps more likely, about exams that you sat at school. For many, they are an acutely stressful time. Now imagine sitting those exams in the kinds of temperatures that many parts of the country experienced this summer. Though most of exam season fell just outside this summer's heat waves, it has prompted one exam board to warn of the possibility of a two-tier system developing, where pupils in some schools sit their exams in air-conditioned rooms and others are simply sweltering. Well, that exam board is Cambridge OCR and its managing director is Miles McGinley, and he joins us now. Good morning, Mr. McGinley. Just tell us what concerns you here.
Well, I think you summed it up very nicely. I think we know that some schools and colleges are better equipped than others to handle extreme heat. There was a teacher tap survey through the summer where they're kind of saying 15% of teachers in secondary schools said they had air-conditioned classrooms. And if some schools and colleges can handle hot summers better than others, it is potentially a fairness issue.
Now, this isn't a fairness issue which arose this summer, is it? Because while it was hot, as it often is, and the kind of time that pupils are sitting exams, these exams did not fall during the heatwave, did they?
No, they fell just outside the heatwave. So, you know, I think we've got to kind of think a heatwave's going to become the new normal, you know, and whether, you know, we might not be so lucky in future years.
And what are you actually calling for here? Are you, do you have a specific demand of government, air conditioning in every classroom, for example?
Well, I think, you know, to be clear, the government's climate change committee and its estate strategy is really on top of this. They outlined the need for investment in buildings, infrastructure, air conditioning. And of course, they've allocated, you know, a lot of funding to this over the next few years. I think it's 710 million, but they also have a big rebuilding program. So there is real awareness of this issue and there's money that's going into it as well. But I think our point is that the plans need to be coordinated and prioritised by need. So schools and colleges with the greatest need have what they need in the summer. And you know, I think currently there'll be schools and colleges with lower average temperatures who'll have less need. And there'll be schools and colleges with the facilities they, you know, they need already. So I guess, you know, our plea is let's just focus on the schools and colleges that don't have what they need currently.
Well, do you have a sense from that survey that you mentioned, the Teacher Tap survey, where only 15% of secondary schools in England have air conditioning in classrooms, do you have a sense of what the 85% are? I mean, are you essentially saying this is a two-tier system in which one tier, the air-conditioned tier, are wealthier schools or schools in wealthier areas, or is it not necessarily clear that it breaks down along those lines?
I think, as I say, it's probably more complicated than that. And it's not just about air conditioning, to be clear. I think the government's climate change committee outlines a number of strategies, you know, from ventilation, solar panels, improved insulation, maybe even using heat pumps to provide active cooling. So I think, you know, that survey just gives you a snapshot about air conditioning. And of course, there are a whole range of approaches that schools and colleges can take.
Because there are countries, aren't there? I think the Philippines is an example where exam season has been moved away from the summer because of the effects that extreme heat can have on kids sitting exams. Is that something that you would be potentially saying the government ought to start thinking about here?
I think moving exams early is not a quick solution, and you know, maybe not even a practical one, given how our terms work. You know, and I think, you know, that's why the priority in the short term has to be on investing in buildings, infrastructure, and things like air conditioning. But longer term, we should be considering whether the exam system has enough flexibility to cope with disruption. I think, you know, extreme heat is only one example of that. I think COVID was another. And of course, you know, for GCSEs, you know, assessment is concentrated, you know, into a few weeks of the summer. And, you know, the amount of exams that are sat over a 6-week period can be, you know, in this country, between 24 and 31 hours in comparison to other countries like Canada, Ireland, New Zealand, which have more like 10 to 18 hours. And of course, you know, that intensity of assessment can just provide, you know, well, it can reduce the flexibility maybe and the resilience that we might want.
OK, Miles McGinley, Managing Director of the Cambridge OCR Exam Board. Thanks for joining us.
This Cultural Life. The book kind of wrote itself. I was waking up one morning and this voice started up in my head.
I'm John Wilson, and each week I ask a leading artist about their creative influences and processes.
It's no good just trying to get the reader to have a little dab at the corner of their eye. If you're brave, you can go much, much deeper.
Guests in the new series include the author Sebastian Foakes, the director Nicholas Heitner, and the pianist Mitsuko Uchida.
Endless discovery. Isn't it wonderful?
This Cultural Life with me, John Wilson, is available now on BBC Sounds.
Couple of minutes to seven is the time, weather time. Elizabeth Rizzini's on the line. Morning, Elizabeth.
Hi, Justin. Good morning again. We do need a bit more rain, and there is some in the forecast as we head through this week. There could be some really heavy thundery downpours, in fact, across the south on Tuesday into Tuesday night. Then gradually, those thunderstorms will migrate further northwards as we head through Wednesday and Thursday, and then it'll turn a bit cooler into Friday. But until then, the nights are going to feel quite muggy and sticky again, and temperatures will be rising, particularly towards the south. So today, lovely day. High pressure still right over us. It's going to stay dry for the vast majority, and there'll be a lot of sunshine around as well. Scotland and Northern Ireland, a bit sunnier than it was for most at the weekend. We're starting off with a bit of mist and a bit of fog as well, but it's going to lift and clear very readily as we head through the morning. And then for England and Wales, again, a little bit of mist and fog towards the north. It's a milder start here. Lots of sunshine around, some patchy cloud, and generally for Eastern England, so East Anglia, Lincolnshire, East Yorkshire, it will turn a lot cloudier through the afternoon. We're likely to see possibly a few showers by the time it gets to the end of the day. For southwest England and for the Channel Islands, maybe a few showers too. Light to moderate southeasterly winds, top temperatures of 18 to 21 Celsius for most of us, but we could get as high as 24 or 25 degrees for Wales and for parts of southern and western England. And then tonight, for southern Scotland and northeast England, maybe the odd spot of rain, but a thicker cloud for southwest England. Elsewhere, dry with some clear spells. It's milder than last night, lows of 11 to 18 degrees.
Thank you, Elizabeth. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Justin Webb and Henry Zeffman.
It's 7 o'clock on Monday, the 24th of August. The headlines this morning: Andy Burnham will promise Ukraine the technical know-how to produce a long-range missile during a visit to Kiev today. We'll be talking to Jeremy Byrne and to the former head of MI6 at 10 past 7. The families of the two police officers killed by a car travelling on the wrong side of the road have described them as heroes. We'll hear from the forces. Police and Crime Commissioner at 7:30. A new research shows hundreds of dental practices in England have stopped providing NHS treatment.
Coming up in the next hour, the president of UEFA has been speaking about the fate of Gianni Infantino. We'll hear some of that. And we're on a special mission on the trail of a very rare bird.
We've come to a top secret location. All I can say is that we're somewhere in England. I've been told not even to mention the county. If bird spotters knew where it was, they would come here, not just in their hundreds, but in their thousands.
We'll find out if our climate editor has managed to keep the binocular-wielding enthusiasts at bay at 7:20. The BBC News is read by Charles Carroll.
Andy Burnham is making his first overseas trip as Prime Minister to Ukraine, with Kiev set to be given key blueprints to produce long-range missiles. The UK will allow the defence company MBDA to share classified information on British components for the Scalp missile, the French equivalent of the UK's Storm Shadow. The trip's been timed to coincide with the 35th anniversary of Ukraine's independence from the Soviet Union. From Kiev, here's our Ukraine correspondent, Dan Johnson.
The Prime Minister will attend Ukraine's Independence Day celebrations and chair his first meeting of the Coalition of the Willing, the partnership of more than 35 nations backing Ukraine. He'll say he wants the Ukrainian people to hear directly from him that British support will not waver as long as it takes, and that Russia's threats against the UK will only strengthen that resolve. He'll announce the release of classified information enabling Ukraine to make its own version of the Storm Shadow or Scalp missile, which was designed jointly with France. Both nations have had to agree to Ukraine setting up its own production lines for the French variant of the long-range cruise missile. It's capable of hitting targets around 150 miles into Russia, not as far as Ukraine's deep strike drone capability, but it's a significant step in showing the willingness of international partners to share weapons technology. And Ukraine hopes for the same with Patriot interceptor missiles, which it desperately needs to defend against Russian ballistic attacks.
The wife of Matthew Blades, one of the two police officers killed in a crash on the A66 near Middlesbrough on Saturday, has said that he gave his life protecting and serving others. The family of the other officer, Tom Clough, have described him as their hero. The pair were in a police vehicle which was hit by a VW Passat travelling the wrong way along the dual carriageway. Five young men in the Passat also died. Tom Simons reports.
The police watchdog said intelligence reports had been received about incidents involving the Volkswagen Passat. It was believed to have cloned plates. It had activated an automatic number plate camera. This led to a 7-minute pursuit, which ended, likely for safety reasons, when the car turned onto the dual carriageway. The crash happened 10 seconds later. PC Matthew Blades and PC Tom Clough, who were killed, had been tasked with searching the area for the Passat. A video posted last year on a TikTok account believed to belong to one of the occupants of the Passat, Mackay Saddington, showed him and four other young people involved in what appeared to be a police pursuit. BBC analysis suggests the car was being driven on footpaths and parkland in Middlesbrough, with Mackay Saddington in a rear seat.
New analysis suggests that 10% of the dental practices in England which were offering NHS treatment in 2017 have since stopped. The research has been carried out by the independent health think tank the Nuffield Trust, which says only just over half of all practices now provide NHS care. Here's our health editor, Hugh Pym.
Patients have reported that some areas have become dental deserts with a struggle to find any NHS dentists. The Nuffield Trust looked at the fall in the number of NHS practices. In Cornwall, more than a quarter have gone. Devon and Northamptonshire have also seen some of the sharpest reductions. North East London was the only area to see an increase in dentists doing NHS work. The authors said this was creating a two-tier service, dependent on what people can afford and where they live. The British Dental Association said if the government didn't fix and fund NHS dentistry, more dentists could choose to reduce NHS work or stop altogether. The Department of Health said it was changing the contract to make NHS dentistry more sustainable, and more dentists were being trained in areas where they were most needed.
The train operator Cross Country has said that it will provide a full service today after serious disruption yesterday. A power cut in Birmingham affected a control centre, leading to cancellations on routes including Glasgow to Edinburgh, Manchester to Birmingham and Cheltenham to Cardiff. Reform UK will announce today that if the party was in government, priority for social housing in England would be given to young British-born workers, armed forces veterans and married couples with children. There are currently more than 1.3 million households on social housing waiting lists. Here's our political correspondent, Ian Watson.
After a difficult summer for Reform UK, the party is keen to seize the political initiative. As well as giving priority access to council and housing association homes to British workers under 35 and to married parents, the party says it would build 50,000 affordable homes a year without raising taxes to do so. The Conservatives accused Reform UK of making an uncosted pledge. Reform will also restate its policy of evicting non-UK nationals from social housing. Labour say this could see NHS and care workers who've been in the country for a long time lose their homes, but that the overwhelming number of families in social rented housing are UK citizens in any case. The Lib Dems described Reform UK's proposals as a cruel gimmick. Housing is likely to be a major issue at the next general election, and the dividing lines are now being very clearly drawn.
The online fashion retailer Shein says it's seeking a valuation of about £20 billion when its shares go on sale on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange on the 1st of September. 4 years ago, it was being valued at more than £70 billion. The company was founded in China but now has its headquarters in Singapore. The president of European football, Alexander Seferin, has ruled himself out of the running to replace the head of FIFA, Gianni Infantino. The president of World Football's governing body has faced calls to step down since he proposed selling stakes in the World Cup to private investors. Here's our sports reporter, Jane Dougal.
Alexander Seferin has led the revolt against the president of World Football, stating that the body he heads, UEFA, would boycott FIFA competitions unless Gianni Infantino resigned. However, he has ruled himself out of the running to succeed Infantino, were he to leave. In an interview with the Rest is Politics podcast, Seferin said he didn't want the job because he loved working at UEFA and because his credibility would be higher if he wasn't interested in the position. He also reiterated his view that Infantino should step down or face opposition if he seeks re-election at the next FIFA Congress in March.
The UK's rarest breeding bird, the Montagu's Harrier, has successfully reared 6 chicks. A male has bred with 2 females. The 2 nests are a short distance apart. The location has been kept secret because of fears the site would be overwhelmed by bird spotters. Last year was the first time since 2019 that the species had nested successfully in the UK. Mark Thomas from the RSPB says the breed is at risk because it nests on the ground among the crops.
This is a species right on the brink, and climate change is not helping that. And the reason it's not helping it is the harvest here, for example, this year, was like a month earlier than in previous years. So it almost puts any Montagu's harrier nest at the perils of inadvertently being destroyed by farm machinery.
And holidaymakers are being urged to double-check their suitcases before they return home from abroad after a big increase in the number of non-native species stowing away in luggage. The National Centre for Reptile Welfare says the number of calls from people who've discovered exotic creatures when they've arrived home has more than doubled over the past year. Nikki Cardwell has the details.
In the last 2 weeks of July, the National Centre for Reptile Welfare collected 11 geckos, 6 spiders, 4 lizards, several Galapagos millipedes and a hermit crab from British travellers who'd unwittingly brought them home. It's always possible that some form of foreign creature will sneak into your suitcase, but the centre's director, Chris Newman, says for some reason it's happening more and more frequently. He's asking people to check their clothes carefully and give shoes a good shake before they go into your case. And should you find a stowaway, the advice is to trap it with a cup and call the centre for help.
Nicky Cardwell reporting.
Thanks, Charles. It's 9 minutes past seven. The fifth British Prime Minister since Russia launched its full-scale invasion of Ukraine has arrived in Kyiv this morning. Andy Burnham's choice of the country for his first international visit as Prime Minister is intended to be a clear signal that he is just as committed to supporting Ukraine as his predecessors. While in Kyiv, Mr. Burnham will chair his first meeting of the Coalition of the Willing, set up by Britain and France under Keir Starmer, accept an award on behalf of the British people recognising the country's steadfast support for Ukraine, and take part in events marking the 35th anniversary of Ukraine's independence from the Soviet Union. The visit also takes place the day after Ukraine's former defence minister, Mykhailo Fedorov, who was fired last month, told the BBC that President Zelensky should face questions about what he knew of potential corruption in his inner circle. Well, to discuss all of that and more, we're joined by Jeremy Bowen, our international editor. Good morning, Jeremy. How significant is it for Ukraine to have Andy Burnham visit in person?
Good morning. It's reassuring. It is a tangible show of commitment. It's Britain underlining its desire to continue to support Ukraine. The new prime minister has been pretty unequivocal in his rhetoric. Of course, the missile project is a long-term project. It's not going to change anything for some years, as you've already been discussing on the program. Ukraine has an urgent need for interceptors to knock out Russian ballistic missiles. The Russians can produce something probably north of 100 ballistic missiles a month. And Ukraine is very close to running out, or has run out, of the capacity to hit them back. And that means that potentially they face a very, very tough winter, maybe tougher than last winter, not least because things like power and hot water and heating in urban areas often comes from district plants. You don't have boilers in everybody's house. There's one big one for the district. And the Russians know that they can knock that out. They can make life very hard for civilians.
And meanwhile, is there a sense that Russia, for their part, can absorb the kinds of casualties to enable them to just keep striking Ukraine relentlessly through that autumn and winter?
Well, there seems to be, looking at the figures, that Russia is not recruiting as many soldiers as it is losing this year. They have been inducing people to sign up voluntarily by paying men vast amounts of money, life-changing sums of money. But the problem is it's a life-ending process for a lot of them. So they're suffering in that sense in trying to get people to do it. Let me give you a couple of figures which I saw on BBC Monitoring. Actually, they're quite mind-blowing if you think about them. And these were published by the Ukrainian Armed Forces on their Facebook account. So, you know, maybe a pinch of salt is required. But on the 23rd of August, the Ukrainians say they killed and wounded another 1,490 Russian soldiers. That is in a day. And that puts the running total of the war so far at 1.4 million. Ukraine has lost numbers in the hundreds of thousands. But the way that in which Russia is really hurting Ukraine, hurting its economy, hurting the way people live, because sometimes if you're in Kiev between raids, it, you know, it feels like a sort of normal quote-unquote city, but the Russians are disrupting that very much by their capacity to launch ballistic missiles and hypersonic missiles, which Ukraine is unable to stop, and Ukraine's own deep strikes into Russia are not enough to stop them doing that. So I think at the moment the war is poised at this quite fluid moment, and it no longer looks like a bit of a stalemate. It looks like there are things in motion right now which can potentially change the balance. And once again, citizens in the Ukrainian capital are going into their very deep metro system and sleeping there at night because they're scared they might get blown up.
And just briefly, Jeremy, domestically, for President Zelensky, I mentioned Mikhailo Fedorov, the defence minister with whom he'd clearly fallen out and who he sacked. It does feel, from a distance at least, like Volodymyr Zelensky is under more pressure domestically than he has been at previous points during this conflict. Is that right? And does it affect how Andy Burnham should deal with him?
Mr. Fedorov's call for an election has not taken off, that there haven't been vast numbers of people on the streets demanding that. But yes, I think the Russians would be delighted about the political discord in Ukraine. Corruption remains a problem. That is well documented. And the other thing, of course, that Andy Burnham needs to think about, as well as Ukrainian domestic politics, is what his support for Ukraine might do in this country in terms of what the Russians might potentially be able to do for us. They have the capacity to make a lot of mischief if they want to.
Okay, Jeremy Bowen, thank you very much.
And listening to that at 14 minutes past seven is Sir Richard Moore, former head of MI6, who is on the line. Morning to you.
Good morning, Justin.
Just picking up on what Jeremy Bowen was saying, the military balance at the moment between Russia and Ukraine, in your judgment, is what?
Well, it's still a real slog on both sides, but I think Jeremy's right to point out. He's right to use language like mind-blowing for the level of Russian losses that we're still seeing on the front lines. So I think the Ukrainians are holding on well on the front line, despite the Russians still attempting to push forward in various places. I think the more critical and interesting area is the two, again, that Jeremy flagged. One is that clearly the Ukrainians are under pressure from Russian missile strikes on their infrastructure, civilian energy infrastructure. But the Ukrainians are doing an extraordinary job of hitting Russia in the deep, hitting the kind of enabling infrastructure that keeps the Russian military effort going in Ukraine. And that's clearly having a real impact, as well as the sort of appalling slaughter and losses on the front line. Russian economy is clearly finding it hard to cope with the Ukrainian ability to hit them in the deep.
How much of a difference, and when will it make that difference, will this new missile system that they're going to be able to build now have?
Well, I think it's just another element. I'm really pleased to see us making this decision. I mean, I saw as chief, and for me, of course, Ukraine was the sort of seminal issue during my time as chief. I saw successive British prime ministers lean in to supporting the Ukrainians, and we were often the first to go with anti-tank missiles, with tanks, with long-range missiles. And I'm glad to see that sort of attitude of mind continuing here as part of the coalition of the willing. So, you know, as an individual thing, I'm sure, you know, it's just one element of supporting the Ukrainians, but it's a very important signal to give, because the Ukrainians have been extraordinary in building up their own defence industry, and often the most effective way to help them is to help them to build it in Ukraine, because they'll do it faster and quicker than most of the rest of us.
And is it true to say that on the subject of interceptors, which of course they need much more urgently, they really need now, that depends, what, almost entirely on what Donald Trump decides to do when it comes to allowing them the same sort of rights, as it were, to build their own, but on an American tech basis in Ukraine?
Well, they have a lot of capability themselves, the Ukrainians, to intercept, particularly drones. And you will see when you see these accounts of these massive Russian assaults on Ukrainian cities that they're often pretty effective at taking down the drones. The problem is that the missiles, the ballistic missiles that are coming in, they do require higher end kit, and most particularly Patriot. U.S. Patriot interceptors, and they've run very short on them, as Jeremy said, and that is a problem because it means that more of them are getting through than were getting through a few months ago.
Are you concerned at all about Russian retaliation against us?
Look, one has to take it into account very clearly, but it's really important not to be intimidated by bully. Putin is the classic playground bully who claims that someone else started it, and they didn't. He invaded his own neighbour back in February 2022, the most egregious act of unprovoked aggression since the Second World War. And it's really important we come back to that over and over again. So all the UK is doing is supporting the Ukrainians' right to defend themselves against that aggression. So, of course, we need to be mindful of Russian activity. We saw all this, of course, in the UK most prominently. We saw it in 2018 with the fact that they carried out an attack in Salisbury with a nerve agent. So this is not new. And I'm afraid the Russians do have us in their sights, and we have to make sure that we are resilient enough and are able to defend ourselves appropriately against the sort of what is sometimes called grey zone activity from the Russians.
And talking of that, we've had this attack, haven't we, cyber attack on a power station here, which apparently took it out of commission for 4 days. Not, it seems, from the Russians. The suggestion is it possibly comes from Iran, but Iran with Chinese help. But do you think that's likely?
I don't know the ins and outs of that particular incident and who might be responsible, but the fact is that a combination of China, Russia, Iran and North Korea are all focused on cyber attacks against the UK, as they are against many other Western and democratic societies. And again, it comes back to the importance for us of building our own resilience and ability to withstand that.
But given that is the case, I mean, you're a former head of MI6, you're also a former Foreign Office person, you were an ambassador, weren't you? What do we do politically about China? Because we're trying to have, aren't we, in a sense, our cake and eat it. We're importing lots of their cars and all the rest of it. It's a hugely burgeoning trade relationship, which we appear to want to increase. And yet at the same time, we're saying, oh, yes, by the way, as well, they're attacking us.
Well, China is a subject, a very big and complex subject in and of itself, Justin. But in brief, what you need for a country like China, which is clearly and self-evidently a powerful, big state, it's one which is completely integrated into the international economic system, you need a long-term consistent approach to China, which both engages them on the big issues where we need to engage them, for example, safety of AI or climate change, and at the same time is very robust in pushing back when they are doing stuff which is against our interests. And it's important to call them out. And I've said this before, it's very clear on Ukraine, for example, that Chinese support has been absolutely vital to keeping Putin's war going. So, look, there's no simple answer on China. You have to have a balanced, long-term approach that manages both to seize opportunities with them on trade and other things, but also manage any threats that they pose to us.
To Richard Moore, thank you.
It's 21 minutes past seven, and the level of business rates that pubs and hotels pay has been a major concern for the hospitality sector. Well, today the government is trying to address that, or begin addressing that, with a review into how those business rates are calculated for venues in England and Wales. And Will's back with more on that.
Morning again, Henry. Yeah, this review is due to report back in March, with the government calling for the views of landlords, hoteliers and business owners to feed into the process. Jonathan Lawson is the chief executive of Butcombe Group, has more than 120 pubs across the south and southwest of England. Morning.
Good morning.
What do you make of this then?
Well, I think clearly I would welcome
The review, I think it's been understood for some time now, that without getting technical, the methodology for applying business rates and calculating it for pubs and inns is quite clearly unfair by comparison to other large box retailers, warehouses, etc. So I think the review is urgently
And what
needed.
Do you mean by that, Jonathan? What is it that you think is unfair within that calculation? And is that being looked at in this review?
Well, I think we will wait to see what the conclusions come out with, and I will come back to one of the points around timing shortly. But in simple terms, the way that it's calculated for pubs and inns disadvantages us because it tends to look at a kind of fair maintainable trade, which in effect means our rates are being calculated based upon almost turnover, and therefore you are punished for success. And it looks in the entire trading area of that business versus large big box retailers or online retailers operating out of warehouses. Their business rates is calculated on what is deemed to be a market rent for that area and takes very little on board in terms of the revenue that's being driven through that site, which means you, in the simple terms, you can have a very large site paying a relatively low level of business rates versus a relatively small pub doing well paying a very high level of business rates.
One of the other questions that seems to have been raised is about which set of business rates this is going to look at, because obviously, as Henry mentioned in the introduction, it's been a sore spot for hospitality for the last couple of years. It's not looking back, right? It's looking ahead to the next set rather than the raise that we saw come into force in April.
I think that's one of my key concerns. If you look at the timings of this, the review is due to report back in March 27. If you look at when the next rateable valuations will kick in, that's 2029. And I think you need to contrast that to the fact that we were promised a review by Rachel Reeves, an actual reform of business rates in 2024. We've yet to see that materialise. What we have seen from this government is a substantial increase in our costs and taxations. So at the same time as announcing a reform that's never materialised, we saw in the October 24 budget an increase in national insurance contributions that cost our business over £1 million alone.
Should say as well, Rachel Reeves did announce, didn't she, 15% cut in business rates, and we've got a 20% one that Andy Burnham's announced that Henry was reporting on coming next year as well. Jonathan Lawson, Chief Executive of the Butkan Group, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thank you, Will. 25 past seven is the time. Britain's rarest breeding bird is so rare that you may never have heard of it. The Montagu's Harrier is one of the world's most agile birds of prey. This year there are not one but two nests in the UK, both served by the same very busy male. The BBC's climate editor, Justin Rowler, has been given exclusive access as the RSPB fits satellite tags to two of the chicks, hoping to unravel the mystery of their migration to West Africa and back. Here is Justin's report.
Easy, easy, easy. There she is.
God, they're beautiful birds, aren't they?
Absolutely the best, yeah.
RSPB experts are fitting a female Montagu's Harrier with a tiny satellite tag that sits on her back like a rucksack. She is still a chick with wisps of fluffy baby down amongst her dappled brown feathers. But you can see the sleek aerial athlete she'll become. Fully grown, she'll weigh barely a third of a kilo, yet her wings will stretch more than a metre. The RSPB's experts want to understand more about the astonishing journey these birds, so desperately rare in the UK, make.
So we've come to a top secret location. All I can say is that we're somewhere in England. I've been told not even to mention the county, because this bird is so rare that if bird spotters knew where it was, they would come here. Not just in their hundreds, but in their thousands. And these birds, these Montagu Harriers, already have it really tough. As recently as a few years ago, for about a five-year period, none were breeding in the UK. Down from in the 90s, there were as many as 12, 15 breeding pairs.
The bird's feeding behaviour is extraordinary. The male is supporting two females and six chicks across two nests, and he can make up to 10 food deliveries a day. He swoops in carrying prey in his claws, drops it mid-air, and the female twists beneath him to snatch it as it falls. This isn't the first time the RSPB has encountered the male bird, says Mark Thomas, who is head of investigations at the charity.
The male here is an incredibly special bird. So this was ringed as a chick in Wiltshire in 2016. I was present when that bird was ringed. And he's come back this year. He spent 10 days displaying like crazy in the sky at several thousand feet and amazingly attracted two female Montagu's harriers.
But feeding two families isn't his only challenge, Thomas says. Montagu's harriers nest on the ground, hidden among the crops. And climate change is bringing harvests forward.
This is a species right on the brink, and climate change is not helping that. And the reason it's not helping it is the harvest here, for example, this year, was like a month earlier than in previous years. So it almost puts any Montagu's harrier nest at the perils of inadvertently being destroyed by farm machinery.
If the nests aren't found, the chicks would be killed by the combines. The farmers here have fenced the nests off until the young can fly. But surviving the harvest is just the first hurdle, which is where that satellite tag comes in.
So that one's just the rear strap that goes around the back of the flank.
Two of the chicks are getting them because soon they will be leaving Britain.
Wow. And that's a solar cell there, so that's basically beaming as we speak.
And crucially, what is it going to tell us?
It'll tell us where she goes, how she disperses, how long she lives, where she winters, where she'll return to breed.
We know adult birds migrate thousands of miles to West Africa, but much less is known about the young birds, says Thomas.
We just don't know what happens to juvenile Montagu's harriers. It allows us for the first time ever to work out where they're going, what migration route, and how long they'll spend there, and will they come back to the UK in the first year or the second year. And all of that information is the bit that's missing from the jigsaw.
Within weeks, these juvenile birds will be heading south. And now, for the first time, the RSPB will be able to follow two of them into the unknown.
Justin Rowlett there. It's 29 minutes past seven, and at the end of the Premier League's opening weekend, here's Hugh Ferris with the sports news.
Henry, thank you. Good morning again. There was a point during the Premier League game between Newcastle and Liverpool yesterday when Sky Sports commentator Peter Drury called that opening weekend of the new season weird. Few better people from whom to steal an idea then, and few better with whom to talk about it. That's our football correspondent, John Murray, who was also at St James's Park. John, good morning. Before the football,
good morning.
Perhaps a word about the tribute to Kevin Keegan yesterday ahead of a match he no doubt would have approved of.
Yeah, that was something else, I have to say. I don't think it's any understatement to say that Kevin Keegan is one of this country's most prominent sporting figures of the last half century. And you really felt that inside St James's Park yesterday in the midst of what was a truly brilliantly choreographed tribute. And many members of Kevin Keegan's closest family were inside the ground to witness it. And it was such a quirk, wasn't it? The way the fixtures fell, that it was Newcastle against Liverpool, the two clubs he was most closely associated with, and for it to be a match that produced four goals, thrills and spills, dramatic equaliser in the ninth minute of added time, even though that provided agony for Newcastle, and as well, all under blue skies, sunshine, I think Kevin Keegan would have approved. And as a commentator, the emotion pre-match, I will confess that a little bit like Murray Walker all those years ago, there was a point where I had to stop talking because I had a lump in my throat.
Yeah, it came at the end of a weekend which saw Manchester United being beaten by Hull, who are one of two promoted teams winning. Spurs, they spent heavily over the summer. They lost heavily on Saturday. Aston Villa conceded four goals in the first half at Brighton. Erling Haaland now has short hair. The advice is to not draw conclusions too early, but that won't stop us, John. So what did you make of the opening weekend?
Yeah, it was, as Peter Drury said, you know, it was weird. And I think possibly part of the reason for that is it's come off the back of the World Cup. And I think you have many, many players who are in very different places in a physical sense. I think that has to have provided a part of that. But also so many clubs in flux, Aston Villa being a great case in point there. And I think very interesting to see what those clubs do now in what remains of this summer transfer window.
Yeah, you've got players arriving back late from the World Cup. You've got players being signed late because of the World Cup. And you've got lots of new managers managers who are attempting to bring all that together despite starting late because of the World Cup. And one of those with the new manager is Xavi Alonso at Chelsea, who play at Fulham tonight. So it's impossible to predict, I guess, what will happen then.
Exactly. And of the 20 clubs, 11 of the managers are starting a season with their current clubs for the first time. And that's the case with both Fulham and Chelsea tonight. Alvaro Arbeloa and Xabi Alonso, bizarrely, who both managed Real Madrid at various points last season. And I think with Chelsea as well, I'm particularly intrigued to see if Alonso can get Chelsea back to challenging to win the Premier League this season, which is something they've not done for a decade. And I think he can.
Well, John, thank you very much indeed. That's our football correspondent, John Murray. Our cricket correspondent, Stefan Schemmel, will be joining us in an hour's time after Brydon Carse was pictured outside a bar in Derby with handcuffs on and surrounded by police officers. The latest disciplinary problem facing England's test team. That's in an hour's time.
Hugh, thank you.
Music that moves you all summer long with the BBC Proms. From Bond and beyond to the Miles Davis centenary. And Elgar's cello concerto. The BBC Proms. Watch on iPlayer, listen on BBC Sounds.
Coming up before 8 o'clock, the president of UEFA has been speaking about the fate of Gianni Infantino. We'll hear some of that alongside the man who interviewed him, Alistair Campbell.
27 minutes to eight is the time. You're listening to Today on Radio 4. Henry Zeffman, Justin Webb and Charles Carroll with the news.
Andy Burnham has arrived in Kyiv on what is his first foreign visit as Prime Minister. There he'll chair a meeting of countries known as the Coalition of the Willing, who have pledged to support Ukraine. The UK will allow a defence company to share classified information with Kyiv on British components for the Anglo-French Scalp missile, which has long-range strike capabilities. The wife of Matthew Blades, one of the two police officers killed in a crash on the A66 near Middlesbrough on Saturday, has said that he gave his life protecting and serving others. The family of the other officer, Tom Clough, have described him as their hero. The pair were in a police car which was hit by a VW Passat travelling the wrong way along the dual carriageway. Five young men in the Passat also died. New analysis suggests that 10% of the dental practices in England which were offering NHS treatment in 2017 have since stopped. The research has been carried out by the independent health think tank the Nuffield Trust, which says only just over half of all practices now provide NHS care. The Department of Health says it's changing the contract to make NHS dentistry more sustainable. The train operator Cross Country has said that it will run a full service today. After serious disruption yesterday, a power cut in Birmingham affected a control centre, leading to cancellations on many routes. Reform UK says that it would prioritise British-born workers under 35, armed forces veterans and married couples with children for social housing if the party gets into power. The homelessness charity Shelter has criticised the plans, saying the solution to the housing shortage is to build more social homes, not change the order of the queue. And the fast fashion retailer Shein, which was founded in China, has announced its shares will start trading on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange at the start of next month. The listing will value the company at up to £20 billion.
Thank you. That 24 minutes to 8 is the time. The families of the two police officers killed in that head-on crash near Middlesbrough have been talking about them and about their bravery. It has emerged that one of them, PC Tom Clough, was a veteran of the Iraq War. He and Matthew Blades were killed in a collision on the A66, which left five other people dead. PC Blades was described by his wife as loved beyond words. He gave his life, she said, in the line of duty, protecting and serving others with courage, dedication and selflessness. PC Clough's family have said he always was ready to help anyone for any reason. The BBC has been talking to some local residents who've been visiting the scene to pay their respects.
We know how much communities need police. You know, our family, we've relied on the police a few times, and we've come to get to know quite a few of them. So to have heard the tragedy that happened, although we don't know the police personally, it's tragedy.
And to hear that there's two 999 officers that are no longer in the Cleveland Police is... it's devastating. There's not enough officers, it is, and they're all just so committed to the community, and to know that two young men that's not much older than my husband has died, and fathers aren't coming home now. It's just, it will affect a whole community.
I've been talking to Matt Story, who is the Police and Crime Commissioner for Cleveland Police. And we started with those statements from PC Clough and PC Blade's families.
I mean, it's absolutely heartbreaking to hear the statements from the families. Obviously, their lives have been cut tragically short, and they clearly had a real sense of that civic duty through the work that they do as police officers. And, you know, my heart goes out to their families today, and you know, the impact that that's going to have on them and the grief they must be feeling is difficult to comprehend, really.
It is a reminder, isn't it, of the day-to-day risks that police officers take.
Absolutely. I think that this is emblematic of how dangerous the job can be. And officers will respond to calls. They'll go to a job and they won't know what's behind the door. They won't know what will happen when they get there. And, you know, it can be incredibly dangerous. And they do take their lives into their hands. And I think it's important for us all to remember in our communities the sacrifices that police officers make every single day and the risks they put themselves under for us to keep us safe.
What more is being said about this incident? What do we know? I think there is going to be a police statement, a police press conference later in the morning. What can you say at the moment about what we know happened?
I can't comment a huge amount more than what the IOPC have said yesterday. I think it's clear that there was a pursuit, it was aborted, and the vehicle that was involved in the crash, the police vehicle, was trying to find the car, the Passat, and try and get that vehicle off the road. They were just on the way to try and work out where it was. So I think it's clearly... that's clearly the way the IOPC is seeing it. They'll be doing more investigations. There'll be more detailed context behind that as they do their work. And we'll just have to see what more comes out in the course of events, really.
There has been speculation that at least one of the young men who were killed had been involved in taking videos in cars before and showing them on TikTok.
Yeah, there has been speculation around that. But what I've been trying to say all throughout this is it's really best for people to avoid that kind of speculation. I think we need to let the IOPC and Cleveland Police do their investigations free from any of that social media noise. You know, if people are hearing rumours or they're seeing speculation online, it can cause upset to the families as well in that respect. So I think what we need to try and do is let the IOPC do what they do and get to the bottom of exactly the detail around this. There's a fair amount of detail in their initial statement, but hopefully more of that will come out. But best not to speculate on anything like that at this stage.
In a wider sense, though, whether or not it was involved this crash, that practice of taking videos in high-speed cars and sharing it online is a worrying new trend, isn't it, or newish trend?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, having said that, I've, without being able to say whether that was anything like involved in this case, it's absolutely idiotic for anybody to be doing anything other than being completely 100% focused on the road when they're behind the wheel of a vehicle. And for somebody to be filming themselves or doing anything like that is absolutely ridiculous. And of course, nobody should be doing that. And it is a worrying situation if that's becoming more prevalent, because it is incredibly dangerous. As I say, it may not have been the case in this situation. We don't know. But anybody who is doing that, wherever it might be, is absolutely wrong to do so.
Matt Story, thank you very much for talking to us.
Thanks.
At 19 minutes to 8, how far is UEFA, the European Football Confederation, prepared to go in its efforts to oust the FIFA president Gianni Infantino over his now abandoned plan to sell stakes in competitions like the World Cup? Well, UEFA's president, Alexander Čeferin, has given an interview to The Rest Is Politics Leading, hosted by Alistair Campbell, in which he discusses whether Infantino could be pushed out of the top job in world football.
Things are changing every day. Every day there are different discussions. I didn't speak with him. He didn't contact me since this happened. But there are two options. One option is that he realizes that he doesn't have the support. And that's not only a political support of the ones who vote, but the political support of football community, the political support of fans, the political support of the players, former players, coaches. And the second option is that he goes to the elections in March, But in that case, I think he will have a candidate against him. I don't know yet who.
Well, Alistair Campbell, who conducted that interview with Alexander Čeferin, is on the line now. Good morning, Mr. Campbell.
Hi, Henry.
Give us a bit more of a sense of what Alexander Čeferin said about UEFA's campaign against Mr. Infantino.
Well, I think he sees this as a battle for the soul of football against people like Infantino, who frankly would sell their own souls for money and power. The more you hear of the way Infantino conducts himself, the more alarming his behaviour becomes. Čeferin, as the UEFA president, is automatically, along with the heads of other regional bodies, a vice president of FIFA. And yet none of them, so far as I can make out, knew about the ridiculous peace prize for Donald Trump. None of them knew that the Somali referee was going to get kicked out. None of them knew about the way that Iran was going to be treated, being forced to fly backwards and forwards between Mexico and the States. He was not discussed. He was not consulted about the Balogun red card incident. So what you have is a sense of Infantino absolutely thinking that football belongs to him. And if you think that football belongs to you, then, and you are interested in money and power, and I think we know that he is, then don't be too surprised if he tries to sell off the game. What I got from the interview with Mr. Čeferin is that he, as the head of the most powerful and the richest football body in the world, is absolutely determined that this plan is dead, it's not going to happen, and that Infantino is done.
And when it comes to what means UEFA is willing to pursue in terms of ensuring that Infantino is done, as you put it, there's this idea of a boycott of FIFA tournaments by UEFA teams, and obviously the English national team is one of those. There's a FIFA tournament taking place in early September, in just a couple of weeks' time, the Under-20s Women's World Cup. England have just named their squad. Did you get any sense from this interview of whether UEFA are going to begin by boycotting that tournament that soon?
They are, as far as they're concerned, the World Cup privatisation plan is dead because Infantino has kind of acknowledged that. And the other thing, of course, is very interesting, is that those people that he was building the plan with, including a member of the Kushner family in the United States, they appear to have accepted that for now that's dead. So that, as to whether that specific tournament goes on, I suspect it will. But what is clear to me is that, you know, remember that Infantino came out of UEFA. He became the head of FIFA with the support of UEFA. That's 55 votes out of 211. And what you see now is this pathetic sight of Infantino scrabbling around on his private jets from, you know, countries in Africa, countries in Latin America, the poorest countries, where he can say, we can give you more money. Now, what one of the delegates from at the UEFA conference of the 55 nations, when they decided that they would announce the boycott, one of them said, he's basically taking our money to buy our own house. It is not FIFA's money. The money is given by bodies like UEFA. So I think Infantino is utterly delusional if he thinks either that football, the leaders of football are going to support him. But also, imagine if Infantino went to a football match now. Let's say he'd gone with Andy Burnham to the Everton game the other day. Let's say he went to see Bayern Munich or any club in France, any club in Germany, any club in Italy. He's just going to get howled out of the place. And he's just delusional if he thinks he can tough this out.
But, as you mentioned, he's going around trying to shore up his power base, which is not UEFA, it's other confederations, perhaps traditionally poorer football federations. That is how Sepp Blatter shored up his power, when you also had European football bodies, including the English FA, arguing that he should go. I mean, it does feel too soon to count Infantino out when it comes to those elections in March, doesn't it?
Listen, in the end, as LBJ said, as Johnson said, it's all about the numbers. Paula, this is a very, very political organisation. It's a very, very political sport. But I think that what's happened with Infantino, he is honestly behaving like a dictator. He's got too close to Trump. He's adopted some of his habits. And yes, he may be able to sort of shift a few votes here and there. But don't forget, he came out of UEFA. The one thing Alexander Čeferin did talk to me about in detail was the nature of the conversations that he was having, not just with the 55 nations in Europe, but around the world, of organisations who I think do understand just how serious this is for the game of football. And of course, football is not just about its leaders. It's the most popular sport in the world. There are literally billions of people who love football. And this is a guy who, for his own vanity, his own narcissism, his own power, is trying to cling on to a job that few actually want him to continue doing. And you made the comparison with Sepp Blatter, and you're right that the English Football Association went against him at points, and so did others. But this is the first time you've seen anything quite as coordinated as this, of UEFA, the richest, most powerful football body in the world, basically saying, this guy's done.
Okay. Well, Alistair Campbell is, of course, the host of The Rest is Politics, and as part of their leading strand, you can listen to that interview with Alexander Čeferin now. Thank you very much.
8:30 is the time. In a few moments' time, we are in for a stormy autumn, we are told. Are we prepared? Are the hatches properly battened down? First, though, thought for the day. The speaker this morning, Michael Hurley, who's Professor of Literature and Theology at the University of Cambridge. Good morning, Professor.
Good morning. Today is St. Bartholomew's Day. Who cares, you might ask? Well, I'm biased, because Bartholomew is my mother's maiden name, so I've long taken a special interest in the saint's life. He was one of Christ's 12 apostles, whose missionary work took him to India, Armenia, and Persia. But even more than his life, it's his death that fascinates me. If you ever visit the Sistine Chapel in Vatican City, be sure to take binoculars so you can view Michelangelo's The Last Judgment in proper detail. And if you can't get to Rome, just Google the image, and you'll see something you will never forget. Of the many eye-popping things about that fresco, it's the rendering of St. Bartholomew that moves me most. He's sitting on a cloud close to Christ, which should be comforting. But in his right hand he holds a knife, and in his left what looks like the empty costume of a human being, pale, limp, with sunken face and limbs. It's his own skin, which tradition says was flayed from him as a form of torturous execution. He is honoured as a martyr, a word that means witness, and as the Christian Church today recalls his unwavering faith in the face of great peril, it's worth remembering that people around the world continue to offer examples of heroic conscience. On Friday, a 41-year-old Cambridge science graduate, who later trained as a barrister, was convicted in Hong Kong under its national security law of inciting subversion. Chow Hung Tung has already spent nearly 5 years in detention and faces a possible further 10 years for organising Hong Kong's annual vigil for the victims of Tiananmen. Reading about the case, I was struck by a comment from another Hong Kong lawyer. "She's not afraid of anything or anyone," he said, adding that she is an inspiration. Not afraid of anything or anyone. How many of us can honestly claim that? But even if we may never match the seemingly superhuman courage of a Chow Hung Tung or St. Bartholomew, we may still feel inspired by them. Because the lesson of their witness is not in the end about bravery for its own sake. It's about the courage to bear witness. Aristotle placed courage first among the virtues. He didn't call it the greatest, but he put it first, because he understood it's the one that makes all the others possible. We cannot be kind or honest or true if we fear the consequences of being so. We can't stand up for what we believe is right unless we can first find it in ourselves to be brave.
And that was Thought for the Day with Professor Michael Hurley. It brought us to 8:09.
It is time now to prepare for extreme conditions resulting from what is being widely forecast to be the strongest El Niño in living memory. That is the warning from Tony Juniper, the chairman of Natural England, which advises the government on the environment. The Met Office says that the El Niño developing over the Pacific Ocean means that 2027 is very likely to be the hottest on record globally. But in the UK specifically, it leaves us at greater risk of a wet and stormy autumn. Well, Tony Juniper joins us now, and as well as being chairman of Natural England, he is a former director of Friends of the Earth. And we're also joined by Sophie Vipon, director of external affairs at the Climate Change Committee, that also advises the government in their case on climate risks. Good morning, both.
Good morning.
We'll start with you, Tony Juniper, because so much of the debate, the increasingly divided political debate on the climate, has been about emissions, hasn't it? But does this El Niño mean that we need to be thinking more now, in your view, about adaptations?
Yes, well, we need to be thinking about both. And ever since the climate change issue emerged and we were being warned about both the causes and the consequences, it's been very clear that we need to drastically reduce emissions that are causing the problem at the same time as being prepared for the consequences. And this El Niño, I was very interested to see senior scientists who've worked on climate change for many decades now drawing a link between the human warming of the atmosphere and the intensity of this El Niño. So it's often described as a natural event, and it is, but like many other natural weather conditions, it is actually being made more intense and pronounced as a result of the pollution released into the atmosphere already. And so we need to be reducing that pollution at the same time as now preparing for some of the consequences. And this is worldwide. This is a phenomenon linked with the warming of the ocean in the eastern tropical Pacific, and it has worldwide consequences. It can create very dry conditions in the western Pacific, in Borneo, in Australia. It will dry out the Amazon further, thereby increasing fire risk, and it's weakening the Indian monsoon, obviously with implications for more than a billion people. In our part of the world, it may lead to a warmer and wetter autumn and early winter, and may lead to a cold snap at the end of the winter. These are the kinds of impacts that we know from previous El Niños can occur in this part of the world. So it could lead to more extreme conditions, very likely to. The Met Office warned that only last Friday. And with that information in mind, it does seem prudent to make preparations.
Well, let's just be parochial about it for a moment. Talk about the UK. What can we meaningfully do at such short notice? Because this El Niño is going to begin having effects in the UK this autumn and into early 2027.
Yes, well, you know, a lot of work is already underway. The Environment Agency obviously planning for flood events all the time and will be very aware of this particular risk this autumn and advising people about how to prepare their homes and also looking at the infrastructure we need to reduce flood risk. At Natural England, we're looking very closely at nature-based solutions that can be deployed to help reduce flooding, fire, extreme heat effects, for example, through more city and town trees, thereby creating shade and evaporation that helps to take the heat down. But longer term, we're going to have to start thinking about holding more water in the landscape, how we can re-wet previously damp ecosystems like rainforests and peatlands, and to be thinking about how we can have more water storage reservoirs, both on farms and also at larger scale for domestic and industrial use.
Okay, well, let's just talk about another form of infrastructure preparation with Sophie Vipond. Bring her in, Director of External Affairs at the Climate Change Committee, because transport infrastructure could also be affected by the El Niño, couldn't it?
Yes, we know that flooding is the biggest threat to transport at the moment, but we've also seen the impacts of heat on our transport system this summer. There's been a 50% increase in adverse weather impacts on transport over the past 5 years compared to the previous 10. So we do know that our systems are being threatened, and that's both rail and road.
And when it comes to protecting those systems, especially in the short term, to deal with this particular weather pattern, what can we do?
So you're right that there's a difference between kind of long-term and short-term issues. Long-term, we know that the country is built for a climate that no longer exists, and we need to think about drainage, slope stabilisation, flood defences. Short-term, we need to really lean into communications, making sure where there are threats to life and threats to travel, that people are communicated with directly and that systems and are talking, you know, direct communication. Those that use the transport systems as well as those that run them.
Okay, and just a final word perhaps for Tony Juniper, because this is all very expensive, and I know that you are not the Chancellor of the Exchequer, you are the Chairman of Natural England, but in your capacity as the Chairman of Natural England, advising the government on some of these questions of environmental adaptation, how much do you think the government should be spending on it when they have so many pressures on the public finances?
Yes, we're very aware of the pressures on public finances, but one thing that we would say is that we by taking a landscape view, a broader view of what kind of changes to land use and what might be done in different places in a more integrated way, looking at agriculture, water, fire risk together, rather than looking at them separately, we might be able to make more impact with the budgets we have. And nature-based solutions are a really good example of this. For example, by creating the right kinds of wetlands in the right place, not only can we store water to keep the landscape more humid and therefore more drought resilient, but also we can reduce flood risk at the same time and also provide a very welcome boost to biodiversity. And sometimes those kinds of solutions will be cheaper than engineered preparations, okay, creating flood defences, right, and so on. And so we probably
Tony
can
Juniper, we're going to have to leave it there, I'm afraid. But message heard loud and clear. Tony Juniper and Sophie Vipon, thank you very much.
A couple of minutes to eight. Let's look ahead now to later this morning on Radio 4.
Neurodivergent. Neurodiverse. Neurotypical. Words that barely existed in everyday conversation a generation ago, now they're everywhere. But what do they really mean?
My mum would have to explain, Matthew's got autism, Matthew's got ADHD. And that would be the cut and paste explanation of it.
I'm Nathan Filer. In a new series, I'm exploring one of the biggest shifts in how we understand human difference.
The label is not the important part.
All Kinds of Minds begins this morning at 11 on Radio 4 and BBC Science.
It's 2 minutes to eight, and here's Elizabeth with the weather.
Thanks, Henry. Well, we do need some more rain, and there is more to come as we head through this week. Heavy thundery downpours, especially in the south on Tuesday night into Wednesday, and then that heavy thundery rain will push further northwards on Wednesday into Thursday. But for today, it's a dry day. High pressure still very much in charge. It's slowly drifting further eastwards, so we're drawing in more of a southeasterly wind. There's a lot of sunshine around today. We've seen a bit of early mist and fog to start off the morning. Into the afternoon, across eastern areas of England, East Anglia, Lincolnshire, East Yorkshire, possibly a few showers and it will turn cloudier here. And across southwest England and the Channel Islands, there could also be a few showers by the time we get to the end of the day. But elsewhere, it's dry, it's sunny and it's feeling warm again. 18 to 21 degrees Celsius for most of us, but maybe 24, 25 degrees across South Wales and parts of southern and western England. Overnight tonight, perhaps a few spots of rain across southern Scotland and northeast England, and also across southwest England, where there'll be some thicker cloud. But elsewhere, it's dry with clear spells. It's feeling quite warm, rather humid again towards the south. 15 to 18 degrees Celsius here, otherwise 11 to 14 degrees.
Elizabeth, thank you for that. You are listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Henry Zeffman and Justin Webb.
It's 8 o'clock on Monday the 24th of August. The headlines. Andy Burnham has arrived in Ukraine, where he'll offer Kyiv the technical know-how to produce its own long-range missile. We'll hear from inside Ukraine at 10 past 8 and ask a defence minister what we should make of the Prime Minister's first foreign visit. The families of the two police officers killed by a car travelling on the wrong side of the road have described them as heroes. And hundreds of dentists in England have stopped offering NHS treatment, according to analysis of so-called dental deserts.
Coming up in the next hour, the Harvard historian Jill Lepore on why people will rebel against a future ruled by tech bosses and their vision of artificial intelligence.
Wait, I didn't vote for these guys. I didn't want this stuff. I don't even need these tools. My job's really meaningful to me. I don't want universal basic income and to sit around and have robot slaves deliver me things.
Meanwhile, back in the world of human intelligence, or at least knowledge, how's this?
The 1940s moquette known as Roundel or Bullseye was originally attributed to Eddie Chapman, but was later discovered to be the work of which other designer?
Joy Jarvis.
It was Joy Jarvis.
We'll talk to the mastermind contestant who's become an internet sensation for having a very niche specialist subject. The BBC News is read this morning by Charles Carroll.
Andy Burnham is making his first overseas trip as Prime Minister to Ukraine, with Kyiv set to be given key blueprints to produce long-range missiles. The UK will allow the defence company MBDA to share classified information on British components for the Scalp missile, the French equivalent of the UK's Storm Shadow. The trip's been timed to coincide with the 35th anniversary of Ukraine's independence from the Soviet Union. From Kyiv, here's our Ukraine correspondent, Dan Johnson.
The Prime Minister will attend Ukraine's Independence Day celebrations and chair his first meeting of the Coalition of the Willing, the partnership of more than 35 nations backing Ukraine. He'll say he wants the Ukrainian people to hear directly from him that British support will not waver as long as it takes and that Russia's threats against the UK will only strengthen that resolve. He'll announce the release of classified information enabling Ukraine to make its own version of the Storm Shadow or Scalp missile, which was designed jointly with France. Both nations have had to agree to Ukraine setting up its own production lines for the French variant of the long-range cruise missile. It's capable of hitting targets around 150 miles into Russia, not as far as Ukraine's deep strike drone capability, but it's a significant step in showing the willingness of international partners to share weapons technology. And Ukraine hopes for the same with Patriot interceptor missiles, which it desperately needs to defend against Russian ballistic attacks.
The wife of Matthew Blades, one of the two police officers killed in a crash on the A66 near Middlesbrough on Saturday, has said he gave his life protecting and serving others. The family of the other officer, Tom Clough, have described him as their hero. The pair were in a police vehicle which was hit by a VW Passat travelling the wrong way along the dual carriageway. Five young men in the Passat also died. Tom Simons reports.
The police watchdog said intelligence reports had been received about incidents involving the Volkswagen Passat. It was believed to have cloned plates. It had activated an automatic number plate camera. This led to a 7-minute pursuit, which ended, likely for safety reasons, when the car turned onto the dual carriageway. The crash happened 10 seconds later. PC Matthew Blades and PC Tom Clough, who were killed, had been tasked with searching the area for the Passat. A video posted last year on a TikTok account believed to belong to one of the occupants of the Passat, Mackay Saddington, showed him and four other young people involved in what appeared to be a police pursuit. BBC analysis suggests the car was being driven on footpaths and parkland in Middlesbrough, with Mackay Saddington in a rear seat.
The Defence Minister, Luke Pollard, says the government has told TikTok and other social media companies to take down content showing people driving the wrong way down roads. Mr Pollard described such clips as awful and said it was time for firms to step up. New analysis suggests that 10% of the dental practices in England which were offering NHS treatment in 2017 have since stopped. The research has been carried out by the independent health think tank the Nuffield Trust, which says only just over half of all practices now provide NHS care. Here's our health editor, Hugh Pym.
Patients have reported that some areas have become dental deserts with a struggle to find any NHS dentists. The Nuffield Trust looked at the fall in the number of NHS practices. In Cornwall, more than a quarter have gone. Devon and Northamptonshire have also seen some of the sharpest reductions. North East London was the only area to see an increase in dentists doing NHS work. The authors said this was creating a two-tier service, dependent on what people can afford and where they live. The British Dental Association said if the government didn't fix and fund NHS dentistry, more dentists could choose to reduce NHS work or stop altogether. The Department of Health said it was changing the contract to make NHS dentistry more sustainable, and more dentists were being trained in areas where they were most needed.
The train operator Cross Country has said that it will run a full service today after serious disruption yesterday. A power cut in Birmingham affected a control centre, leading to widespread cancellations. Reform UK has said that if it were in government, it would give priority for new social housing tenancies in England to people born in Britain. British citizens born overseas who were currently in social housing would be allowed to remain. Here's our political correspondent, Jack Fenwick.
After months of difficult questions for Reform, including on Nigel Farage's finances, the party is keen to seize the political initiative with a flurry of policy announcements. Under a Reform government, British-born people would be prioritised over those born abroad for new social housing tenancies. Access to council and housing association homes would be easier for British workers under 35 and married parents, and the party says it would build 50,000 affordable homes a year without raising taxes to do so. The Conservatives accused Reform UK of making an uncosted pledge. Reform will also restate its policy of evicting non-UK nationals from social housing. Labour say this could see NHS and care workers who have been in the country for a long time lose their homes, but that the overwhelming number of families in social rented housing are UK citizens in any case. The Lib Dems described Reform UK's proposals as a cruel gimmick.
The online fashion retailer Shein says that it's seeking a valuation of about £20 billion when its shares go on sale on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange on the 1st of September. 4 years ago, it was being valued at more than £70 billion. The company was founded in China but now has its headquarters in Singapore. The Treasury has set up an independent review to look at how business rates are calculated for pubs and hotels in England and Wales. Landlords, brewers, hoteliers and business owners are being encouraged to submit evidence. The review will report back with recommendations at the end of March. More than 40,000 people in the US state of Nevada have evacuated their homes as a wildfire approaches the outskirts of the city of Reno. A similar number of people have been told to get ready to leave. The blaze now covers 15,000 acres. Here's our North America correspondent, David Willis.
Several homes in the city of Reno have already been destroyed by the blaze, and so fast are the flames moving that officials have widened their original evacuation order to include an area near the state borders with Oregon and California. Nevada's governor, Joe Lombardo, has declared a state of emergency, and National Guard officers are being drafted in to support aerial firefighting efforts and safeguard evacuated neighborhoods. Reno is a gambling town, and casinos there are offering discounts on hotel rooms to those forced to flee the flames. But more than 400 people spent the night at the city's convention center, which has been turned into a shelter for evacuees.
The UK's rarest breeding bird, the Montagu's Harrier, has successfully reared six chicks after building two nests at a secret location. Conservationists have now tagged two of the juvenile females in the hope of learning more about their annual migration to Africa. Our climate editor, Justin Rowlett, has been following their fortunes.
The Montagu's Harrier is vanishingly rare here in the UK. No chicks have been successfully raised here for the 5 years to 2024. The species was placed on the red list of birds most at risk in 2021. I can't even tell you in which county they're nesting for fear the site would be overwhelmed by bird spotters. The adult harriers winter in West Africa before migrating thousands of miles to Europe to breed, nesting on the ground amongst crops. The RSPB says climate change is making this riskier as it's bringing harvests forward, increasing the chances that nests are destroyed by combine harvesters. This year, a male, known as AU, managed to breed with two new females, with two nests a short distance apart. Farmers have worked with the RSPB to protect the chicks.
Holidaymakers are being urged to double-check their suitcases before they return from abroad after a big increase in the number of non-native species stowing away in luggage. The National Centre for Reptile Welfare says that in the last 2 weeks of July, staff collected 11 geckos, 6 spiders, 4 lizards, several Galapagos millipedes and a hermit crab from returning tourists. The centre's director, Chris Newman, says there are steps people can take to ensure that they don't pack an unexpected souvenir.
What would be great is if people could actually just take a little bit of time and just shake their clothing out. And particularly for shoes and things like that, this is not so much for the geckos, but things like, which may surprise people, quite big toads, particularly around the Mediterranean, North Africa area, seem to like getting into shoes and things like that. So again, you pack your shoes in the bottom of the suitcase very quickly, you don't check in it, and when you come home, lo and behold, you've brought a great big toad back with you.
Chris Newman of the National Centre for Reptile Welfare.
Thank you for that. 8:10 is the time. It was in May this year at the annual military parade in Moscow that the threat of long-range attack from Ukraine really seemed to hit home for Vladimir Putin. He had to scale back that parade, you'll remember, for fear of attack from drones or missiles. President Zelensky at the time issuing a statement saying, "I hereby decree to permit the holding of a parade in the city of Moscow." That's the difference that long-range threats have made. And in theory, those long-range threats to Russia will be increased by the news that blueprints for British technology used in a missile system can be handed over to Kiev, but not immediately, Of course, the more urgent need for Ukraine is the ability to defend itself with missile interceptors, and they are desperately short of those, in part because many of the American ones have been used to defend Israel and the Gulf states against Iran. That's the context, then, for the announcement Andy Burnham is making in Kiev this morning. The Prime Minister, of course, on his first foreign trip. And joining us now from Kiev is Vladimir Avrilov, who is a retired Major General, former Ukrainian Deputy Minister of Defence. He was doing that job during the full-scale invasion in 2022. He's also worked with the Atlantic Council think tank. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Can Ukraine still win this war?
We have no doubts here in Ukraine that we will prevail in this conflict, given the energy of our civil society and the strong support from our partners. And so
And what difference will the missile system or the intelligence for the missile system that Andy Burnham is talking about today, what difference will that make?
It's a very important contribution to the efforts, domestic efforts here in Ukraine to increase our deep strike and mid-strike capability. Now we are doing that with our drones, which are redesigned in Ukraine and on the significant production now here. At the same time, we're also using some British capability, cruise missiles, and our companies are working very closely with United Kingdom companies on missile technologies, meaning we have to improve the performance of the missile capability, which is on the rise in Ukraine.
Will the new missile capability, when it becomes available, the missile capability that Andy Burnham is talking about today, will that enable Ukraine to hit different targets or just to hit the same sort of targets more often?
First of all, if we are talking about the drones, we are able to reach targets up to 2,000 kilometers now deep in Russia. At the same time, we really need to develop the ballistic capability of Ukraine and also cruise missile capability together with our partners to reach the important targets near the central side, part of Russia, in the Moscow area and St. Petersburg area. And there is the biggest concentration of defense industry of Russia, which is supporting Russian missile programs and Russian military.
Right, so these missiles would be aimed at those targets?
Yes, and Russia doesn't have capability to intercept ballistics. So they have some systems, but they are not so effective like Patriot or like that. That's why it would be a kind of game changer when the first Ukrainian ballistic missile will reach some kind of targets close to Moscow with all this information coming inside the Russian society to understand that something different is going on in this war.
Really? You would go so far as to say it could be a game changer?
Yes, I think it will be a game changer because this war is all about reciprocity. So we didn't have any kind of capability to respond to Russian ballistic missiles or other attacks on our territory until 2026. In 2026, we succeeded to scale up sufficiently to scale up the production of our domestic designs of long-range drones and middle-range drones. And also we contributed a lot in the ballistic missile program in Ukraine and cruise missile. And it gave us a capability to reach Russian targets on the territory of Russia, deep in Russia. And we immediately started to understand that is a game changer because the Russians started to react differently inside the country about that. And we are very confident that the next step, ballistic capability, will contribute to the outcome of this war.
Volodymyr Avrilov, thank you very much for talking to us and listening to that. Here in Britain is Luke Pollard, the defence minister, who's on the line now. Morning to you.
Morning, Justin.
Interesting to hear that described there as a game changer, this new technology that we're helping to provide to Ukraine. Do you think we are ready for Russia's response to something that we are doing that does provide potentially such a big alteration in the balance of the war?
It certainly will make a big contribution, and the ballistic missiles that the previous speaker was talking about will certainly make an even bigger contribution. The Scalp missile that we are working with our French allies on to provide to Ukraine is a slightly different type of missile than the one I believe he was talking about, but nonetheless will be a really important contribution by releasing the UK technology within that. That enables Ukraine to develop their own capabilities, which creates the added deterrence against this. Now, I've seen lots of threats from Russia, lots of press releases. They're designed to erode support for Ukraine. They're designed to put questions into the public's eyes, to use the best part of our democracy, our debate against us. But they should be in no doubt that the support that the United Kingdom is offering Ukraine is long-lasting. We will continue supporting them for as long as it takes. And having the Prime Minister make his first overseas visit, his first international visit to Kyiv to chair a coalition of the willing meeting, I think sends a very strong signal about his personal support for President Zelensky and the Ukrainian people, but also the long-lasting support for from the UK.
Yeah, tell us more about the Scalp missile, because it's important to get this right, isn't it? So what Mr. Havrilov is talking about is just the ability more generally, with ballistic missiles in particular, but the ability more generally to strike at longer range targets. The Scalp missile is what? It's not that long range. What potentially does it add to the armoury of Ukraine?
So the Scalp missile, that is the French designation for it, sometimes better known in the United Kingdom as a Storm Shadow, is a precision weapon system. It's something that has been in the UK inventory for quite some time, and it enables a more precise hit on a target. Now, the reason that this is useful for our friends in Ukraine is because it creates more deterrence against Russian aggression. It means that they can hit targets, but they can also create more difficulties in the eyes of an adversary about where they put their kit and equipment. As you've already have heard, Ukraine has the ability to strike well into Russia already using their own indigenously produced technologies, as well as those using technologies from friends far and wide. And so they have a range of capabilities already. And this reflects, I think, your introduction to this segment, that Ukraine needs technologies in a whole array of areas. Yes, they need more air defence, and that's why the United Kingdom is providing more air defence to take down cruise missiles, but also counter-drone capabilities to take down Shahids and other drones like that, that Russia's firing at not just military installations, but increasingly at civilian populations, at housing, at shopping centres. That is something that is not only illegal in international law, it speaks to the type of campaign that Putin is waging, and one that just, I think, in my mind, reinforces why the United Kingdom is right to stand with Ukraine against this type of illegal activity.
To stand with Ukraine and to spend more on defence, and the government has made it clear, and Andy Burnham is making it clear, that although they're not talking in detail yet, we are going to be spending more on defence. And yet, we spend twice as much, don't we, at the moment, on servicing our debt, our national debt, than we do on defence. In other words, the balance to many people seems to be wrong. We're not properly on a war footing because we still want to spend money on so many other things. Andy Burnham letting it be known the other day, I think, or his people letting it be known that potentially we want to go back to spending more on foreign aid, etc. All of it borrowed money. What would you say to people about the sacrifices that we all potentially will need to make if Ukraine is to be properly supported?
Well, we're continuing to support Ukraine with £3 billion a year in military support. We've been able to use some of the immobilised Russian assets in the UK to provide additional support in recent years. But we know the threats that the United Kingdom is facing are increasing. And that's why we've increased the defence budget. So roughly it was £52-54 billion a year when we came to office. By the end of this parliament, it will be £72 billion, £20 billion extra. But we do want to see more money spent on defence. And as a defence minister, I've been pretty vocal. I want more money spent on defence.
Yeah, but my question wasn't so much about the need to spend more money, which everyone seems to be accepting. It's just whether or not we have as a nation begun to think about the sacrifices we might all of us have to make in order for that to happen.
Yeah, so I think there's an important part of having a national conversation. It was one of the recommendations in the Strategic Defence Review that came out, that was published by George Robertson, the former NATO Secretary General. He advocated that kind of national conversation that starts looking at what steps are necessary to defend our country in more uncertain times. Increased defence spending is certainly one of those. I want more of that defence spending spent with British companies, and that's what we're seeing under this government. And that creates more job opportunities, which motors the economy. Defence really is an engine for growth if we spend it with UK firms. Of course, we have to collaborate internationally, and we'll continue to do so. But where we can spend it with British firms, it creates more opportunities for graduates, more opportunities for apprentices, more opportunity for reskilling, and that helps our economy. And so more defence spending can be one of the tools that the Chancellor can use to grow our economy, to create more energy within our economy, and therefore more taxation at one end to pay for the public services that we all rely on. And that includes our national security.
Just want to ask you a final question, if I may, about the awful events in the A66 near Middlesbrough, this terrible crash that's taken the lives of two police officers. Some suggestions that there has been content, at least in the past, and we don't know whether it's relevant in this case or not, but this social media trend showing people driving the wrong way down roads. Mm. Do the social media companies, in your view, in the government's view, bear some responsibility for dealing with that?
So, I mean, it's an appalling tragedy. My thoughts go out to the families of the victims, especially the police officers who go to work every day to keep us safe. It's right that we give the police space to do their investigation. And if there's any lessons to be learned, we certainly will. But in the meantime, the government's already had conversations with social media companies, asking them, working with them to take down that type of content. Because we know that if you have content online that celebrates this dangerous behaviour, driving on the wrong side of the road, turning your lights off while driving at speed at night, it encourages other people to do so as well. And on social media, the way the algorithms work is it spools up controversial content, it serves it to more people. The social media companies benefit from that, and the creators of that content can benefit from it as well. And that's why I think the opportunities for social media companies to recognize that this content is particularly dangerous, that there is an acute public concern about it, is something that they could act on today. And I hope that by colleagues across government working with those social media companies, that content can be taken down. But I really hope that somewhere within those big tech companies, there's just an understanding that celebrating such dangerous behaviour might create a sugar rush of some increased views in the short term for them, but it's bad for their business model and it's bad for society as a whole. And if we can have social media companies policing themselves better, as well as governments taking proportionate steps to encourage everyone to be safe online and safe on our roads, then I think we'll be in a much better place.
Luke Pollard, thank you very much.
At 24 minutes past eight, nearly 3 million Teslas have been recalled in China because of their hidden door handles. The retractable door handles, which are sleek, minimalistic, and, according it seems to the Chinese state, dangerous. That's because they're deemed difficult to locate and open in emergency situations. Now, Tesla are not the only brand affected by the recall. Others include Chinese car makers XPeng, Geely and Xiaomi, which prompted the concern after two fatal crashes in China involving its electric vehicles where power failures were suspected to have prevented the doors from being opened. Well, to explain more about this, we're joined by Amanda Stretton, motoring journalist and former racing driver, and Peter Baden-Flett Hansen, who worked for Tesla for 10 years until 2019 as head of business development for Europe, the Middle East and Africa. Thank you both very much for joining us this morning. Let's start with you, Amanda Stretton. Could you just explain to those who haven't seen these cars or been in these cars what these hidden door handles look like and why that could cause problems in an emergency?
Sure. So these are handles that are flush with the actual door panel itself. Either that or they're maybe hidden behind part of the side of the door. And the idea is that when you either drive past the car or, sorry, walk past the car or activate the key, these door handles will pop out. The point is that they are operated by the low voltage battery system, and therefore the question has been raised, and in fact it was asked earlier on in the year when China banned the sale of new vehicles with these retractable door handles. What happens in the case of an emergency when the power system fails and the driver is in some way incapacitated and emergency services are trying to get them out?
And the use of this design has snowballed, hasn't it? Particularly among Chinese brands who were trying to copy the sort of sleek look of Tesla's original Model S, which used these back in 2014. Is that right?
Sure. And it's important to remember that it's not just Tesla and Chinese companies that are doing this. High-end brands like Mercedes and Jaguar Land Rover product have also used this design as well. The object of it really is twofold. A, it looks lovely. It looks sleek, modern and very smooth. But also, as we're moving towards an electrification of our fleet, it's another way of creating aerodynamic efficiency. Batteries have a finite amount of energy within them, and so the more you can extend range, the better. And one of the ways of doing that is through lightweighting, but also in aerodynamic efficiency.
Okay, well, Peter Bardenflat-Hansen, you worked at Tesla for a decade. Do you think this recall will be a serious issue for the company?
No, I mean, as we just looked or heard, it's a number of companies that are being asked to do a recall. Although, of course, three quarters of the number of vehicles with these type of retractable door handles are from Tesla, but Tesla will be able to do this. They've done it before. It's not an unusual thing for car companies to do recalls. And Tesla have, over the years, certainly when I worked there, been needed to for, amongst other things, braking systems, seat belts, and other issues that I recall that that they had to do recalls on. And it's a question of putting it into a system, having their engineers find the correct solution for it, and having this implemented. Another thing that I'm hearing here is that, of course, this is becoming a standard from the 1st of Jan 2027. So I'm pretty confident that they already have a solution on the drawing board already that has to be implemented in 6 months anyway.
Yeah, that's for the new cars, as Amanda mentioned.
Exactly.
And just for the existing cars, the ones that aren't being recalled, Tesla say that they'll place warning labels on the recalled vehicles and issue a software update to automatically lower the windows of a car if it's been in a collision. Do you think that sounds like an adequate solution for those cars that are still going to be on the roads in China?
I'm sure that they're going to try, but it may not be taken as good enough problem solve. I've seen, having worked in the industry for a number of years now, specifically using these types of handles for taxis, for instance, that there is, and Tesla has made a retrofit with a mechanical door handle. So I'm pretty confident that they already have that solution ready should they come on and need to be put those in. But of course, they will try to go for the cheapest and easiest solution to start with.
Okay. All right. Well, that's really interesting. Thank you for joining us, Peter Bardenflat-Hansen from Tesla, or previously from Tesla, and Amanda Stretton, motoring journalist and former racing driver.
29 minutes past eight, still to come before 9 o'clock. The Harvard historian Jill Lepore on why people, in her view, are going to rebel against a future ruled by tech bosses and their vision, in particular, of artificial intelligence. First, though, Hugh with the sports news. Hello again, Hugh.
Justin, thank you very much indeed. It is only a matter of days since England's test team attempted to turn the page after a series of disciplinary issues. A new captain, the old curfew abolished, and Joe Root adopting a different tone.
You always want to represent your country in the best possible light. And we might have fallen short of that on a few occasions in the recent past. But the only thing that we can do to rectify that is be really good role models and good human beings.
But now Root and the ECB are dealing with another late-night incident that ended with bowler Brydon Carse pictured in handcuffs surrounded by police officers outside a venue in Derby. He was celebrating Durham's win over Derbyshire in the county championship, having been released from the England squad for the first test against Pakistan, with that same squad due to meet at Lord's for the second game of the series today. Let's speak to our cricket correspondent, Stefan Schemmel. We, Stefan, like the ECB, I imagine, are trying to piece all this together. So what do you know?
Yeah, the footage appeared on social media yesterday afternoon. We don't know why Brydon Carse was in handcuffs, and we understand he was not arrested. But again, it's just another bad look for English cricket after a string of these incidents over the past year. We understand that the ECB have started to investigate. We don't know whether Carse will still be in the England squad for the second test against Pakistan that starts on Thursday. I'd expect a decision on that later on this afternoon.
Well, the first match after the curfew was introduced, the former captain Ben Stokes and Gus Atkinson broke it. The first match after the curfew was abolished, this happens. So what can the ECB do? Because either way, it's not working.
Yeah, in my feeling, there's frustration and anger at the top of the game because these incidents keep happening. 30 men have England central contracts, Hugh. 8 of them have been involved or present in incidents like this in the past year. There's been a curfew, there's been guidelines on drinking. Now Root's removed the curfew and the drinking guidelines are gone. He says there's an idea that if players could are allowed to make good decisions off the field, they'll make good decisions on the field. Something's not working. The top of the game will be tearing their hair out trying to figure out what comes next.
Ben Stokes, when he was still the captain, was subject to the disciplinary effects of being out. After he retired from international cricket, he insisted the England team itself doesn't have a drinking problem. In fact, the whole game does. So this seems like a bit of an institutional problem not easily solved over the course of minor incidents, major incidents over the course of a week or so.
And Stokes has probably got a point with the wider game. I suppose it begs the question of what he did to distance himself from that drinking culture. There's a debate about players being allowed freedom, being allowed to celebrate a win. But there's also an argument to say that cricket is falling behind the times with other sports in terms of professionalism. I can't imagine that Manchester City or Brighton players were out last night after their wins in the Premier League. And in this specific example, Brydon Carse, he's only a hamstring tweak away from one of the other bowlers from playing in a test match at Lord's on Thursday. Is a Saturday night out the best way to prepare for that?
Just briefly, do we consider these cricketers in a different light than we did the cricketers of yesteryear who regale us with stories of drunken nights out and all the hijinks that they used to get up to?
Oh, I can't imagine that Ian Botham would say that these players are under less scrutiny from the media than he was at the height of his fame. He had a greater profile. But there's 2 points. Smartphones. England players will be filmed wherever they go. And the second thing is we often hear with these incidents that these players are just unlucky. They're in the wrong place at the wrong time. Well, maybe stop putting yourself in that place.
Steph, thank you very much indeed. That's our cricket correspondent, Stefan Schemmel.
Hugh, thank you very much. Let's have a look at what's coming up later today on Radio 4.
Human intelligence. Stories of extraordinary minds.
Tesla sees himself as the sole inventor of the future.
I'm Naomi Alderman, and in my landmark series for Radio 4, I'm celebrating trailblazing thinkers who have influenced the course of history.
The two Homeric epics gave us, I think, between them, practically every storyline that we still use.
Who were they? How did they see the world? What made their minds so special?
Emily's looking at the world and recording it with an almost scientific precision.
The new series of Human Intelligence on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. Each weekday afternoon at 1:45.
You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Henry Zeffman and Justin Webb. It is 25 to 9. Charles Carroll has the news.
Andy Burnham has arrived in Ukraine on his first overseas trip as Prime Minister. He'll offer Kiev the blueprints to a long-range missile so that Ukraine can produce its own version. The Defence Minister, Luke Pollard, has told this programme the government has asked social media companies to take down videos of people driving dangerously. He was speaking after two police officers were killed in a crash near Middlesbrough on Saturday involving a car driving the wrong way down the A66. New analysis suggests that 10% of the dental practices in England, which were offering NHS treatment in 2017, have since stopped. The research has been carried out by the independent health think tank, the Nuffield Trust, which says only just over half of all practices now provide NHS care. The Department of Health said it was changing the contract to make NHS dentistry more sustainable. And the train operator Cross Country has said that it will run a full service today after serious disruption yesterday. A power cut in Birmingham affected a control centre, leading to widespread cancellations.
Thank you, Charles. The government is giving elected mayors across England the power to intervene in major planning decisions, allowing them to overrule local councils on large housing and commercial developments. Ministers argue that giving mayors in places like Greater Manchester and the West of England the power to call in planning decisions, like the London mayor already can, will help unblock stalled projects and accelerate house building. Others say this will weaken local democracy by taking planning decisions away from councillors who are elected by the local communities affected. Well, one mayor gaining these powers is Richard Parker, the Labour mayor of the West Midlands and chair of the West Midlands Combined Authority. He joins us now, as does Councillor Roger Harmer, a Liberal Democrat, who's the leader of Birmingham City Council, which is, of course, part of the West Midlands Combined Authority. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Richard Parker, let's start with you. Why do mayors need these powers?
Look, I think some of the response to the powers has probably been a bit of an overreaction and an exaggeration. Look, we're keen to drive delivery. I'm particularly keen to drive delivery on the major investment and employment sites and housing sites across this region. It is, though, about working as mayors, using our convening powers to best effect and, you know, collaborating with our council leaders, and that's what I plan to do. And any powers we have to, or decisions we make over and above those made by councils, have to be consistent with planning rules, local plans, and national policy. So I think, you know, the intention for government is to ensure that, you know, projects and plans, and particularly major sites, aren't held up because of indecision locally. I mean, over the weekend, I was speaking to some major investors into the region, the West Midlands, and major developers that are building across this region. And their biggest frustration currently, frankly, is the time it takes to get decisions. And often it appears to them that, you know, the decisions made are often at the discretion of a small number of people that haven't got a vested interest in projects. But I just want to say, I want to use and will use the powers that I get, you know, responsibly and sparingly. And I do want to work every step of the process with our council and our council partners. This approach to growth and delivery, and including increasing more jobs, has to be a partnership.
OK, well, Roger Harmer, it's a partnership. It's going to be consistent with local plans. Are you reassured by that?
Well, I'm certainly reassured by that approach by the mayor, and we've already worked closely together in engaging with some of the key investors that Birmingham needs to tackle our housing crisis. I mean, I would go back, though. I think that the point about the proposals is wrong in that they weaken local democratic accountability, and they fundamentally don't address the key housing issues we face. We don't have a problem in Birmingham with a lack of planning consent. What we've got is a huge shortage of socially rented housing, over 10,000 children in temporary accommodation. And then the solution to that is about support with viability and tackling the issues in terms of the trained operatives that are needed to build those houses.
Just to spell out that point a bit further, Roger Harmer, you are saying that the big obstacle to house building in Birmingham, at least, is not the planning system.
No, it's about viability of building socially rented housing. We've lost half the council houses that we had 40 years ago in Birmingham. That's about the way right to buy has operated, which has meant that the council has not been financially able to replace the housing stock lost in this way. And that's what we need. We need to start building more council houses, more socially rented houses, so we can get on top of that problem.
OK, Richard Parker, let me just get you to respond first to the point that Roger Harmer made about this weakening local accountability. I mean, you accept that, don't you? You just think that it's worth it for the prize.
Well, look, I think if local accountability works well and responsibly, and councils make decisions that are consistent with the planning rules and their local plans, you know, my ability or need for me to intervene will be limited at best. So, if
this is weakening the ability of councillors to tell you to butt out, isn't it?
Well, no, if they make decisions consistent with local plans, there'll be that you know, there's little for me to intervene for without purpose. I think the biggest benefit for me, and I'll come back to what Roger said, and I think what he's outlined is a pathway for us to work in the way I want to work. He's got major housing needs, particularly around social and affordable housing. It's my biggest priority too. We are working together on some major sites, including six across the Merrill Development Corporation we've put together, and the ability to work consistently with his team and his cabinet to align the council's demand or requirements for social and affordable housing with the resources we deploy is a win-win. And I see so many opportunities. And we have, as mayors, I think, got a real stake in projects. One of the major investment projects in this city currently is around a project called the Sports Quarter, that is the redevelopment of Birmingham City's football club and the land around it. We're putting in a metro that's costing hundreds of millions of pounds to connect the city centre to the Sports Quarter. It makes absolute sense, doesn't it, for me as mayor to work with Roger and his senior team on how we align the planning application for that redevelopment with the transport links we're putting in and the homes that Rogers wants. And I believe we can do that. And that, for me, is the use of convening powers. And if that works well, you know, the need for me, the necessity for me to intervene it won't be needed at all. So I think I think this is really the mayoral intervention of powers are really where things are not working well, or we need a bigger intervention. And I think on those major sites, and we've got a number across the region, Arden Cross, Coventry Airport, the MDC in Birmingham, and one in Wolverhampton, where collaboration is key. And if things work well and we've got that collaboration and the convening powers of the mayors are working well, the need for me to intervene is limited at best. But also, I think we have the ability to work together to get a lot more out of these projects than we are do currently.
OK, it's going to be fascinating to see how this dynamic plays out. Richard Parker, Mayor of the West Midlands, and Roger Harmer, Leader of Birmingham City Council, thanks very much for joining us.
18 minutes to 8 is the time, to 8 to 9. We're going to rebel against the future that our tech and social media overlords are planning for us. Rebel because we're human, we want to keep our humanity. That's the thesis of a new book called The Rise and Fall of the Artificial State. It's from the Harvard Professor of History, Jill Lepore. When I talked to her, we began with a definition. What is this artificial state that she talks about?
The artificial state is a name I'm trying to give to describe what seems to be evolving to supplant the liberal democratic nation state, in which, in lieu of government by consent, we are increasingly governed by machines. But if you think about public discourse, most of what was once called the public sphere is really privately owned, right? The social media platforms on which most people seek news and information about the world are owned by private corporations. They're dominated not by humans, in fact, but by bots at this point. So I think it really calls into question the very nature of a public sphere.
Is it not the case, though, for instance, with newspapers and television and mostly radio in the United States, that actually for some time these have been privately owned places? They're just more accessible now, I suppose, than they were.
Yeah, it is the case that they're privately owned, although they have been rigidly governed, right? Our Federal Communications Commission established rules for what public interest must be attended to in the provision of news on broadcast medium. Now, obviously, that changed with the emergence of cable in the late 1970s and into the 1980s. But you can trace, and in fact, my story doesn't begin with, say, artificial intelligence and social media, but really begins with the lawlessness of the internet as the new communications medium. And its lawlessness was a political project, right? It was a project of libertarians in the United States who were opposed to the FCC and for decades had been trying to overturn the regulations that established public interest commitments of privately owned media corporations in the United States.
But is it your case then that the discussions that happen online, on social media, have been taken over by machines, by spots, that actually this isn't democracy anymore because it's not really individuals talking to individuals, that there's always something else going on behind the scenes.
So I'm a historian, and my contention is that we can excavate a historical process that has been underway for quite some time now. I'm trying to draw attention to the, I think, quite unthinking way in which we have yielded more and more and more of what were necessary elements of democratic deliberation and the participation of citizens and having our interests represented by elected officials to corporations whose technologies replaced our human judgment. Sometimes people have asked me, like, do you mean like the artificial state, like the deep state, like it's a conspiracy? And I don't mean that at all, right? Like, it's largely unintentional. Like, most of this happened by accident. Like, oh, it would be faster, it would be cheaper, we'd reach more people. Like, there's a lot of reasons that people would automate the workings of politics, right? Like, you're running a campaign, you want to reach voters, right? This is going to be, well, you're going to hire a data analytics firm. Okay, but then when you really think about that, maybe you're not going to go do the legwork anymore.
Your book is called The Rise and Fall of the Artificial State. How does it fall? Is it falling?
I became really interested in how much of how we live now was predicted by science fiction, some quite old science fictions. One of my favorite of these stories is called The Machine Stops, and it's by E.M. Forster. It's from 1909. It's right before he publishes Room with a View. It's a sort of a future world. It's kind of H.G. Wellsian, in which everybody lives in these kind of cells and everything is delivered to you. You can communicate with your friends via these screens. You never have to leave. You kind of have like automatic food delivery. Entertainment is kind of piped into your little room. And you live below ground and you never see the natural world. And the natural world is considered to be terrifying. And everyone has one book. It's called The Book of the Machine. The story is called The Machine Stops. And this is why the artificial state always falls. Because the machine that is providing all these things for humans and enfeebling humanity is drawing all of its power from the natural world, whose resources are finite. And so at some point, the machine is going to stop. So there's these warnings like, oh, no, you must leave your little cell and return to the natural world. And either people do that and they survive or they don't do that. And when the machine stops, people die. But that's kind of how the parable always goes. And I think the resources of the natural world can kind of barely support the population of humans. But if we imagine a future world in which we have to consign more and more land that could be used for housing, for growing food, for generating solar power or wind power to data centers that can provide compute power to artificial intelligence that will provide us all with all the things so that we no longer need to work or think or get up to go get a glass of water from the kitchen because a robot will bring it to us. Like, that's the story of the inevitable fall. It's essentially a narrative of the inevitability of the fall of the artificial state.
But what does the fall then look like? Because at the moment, I mean, part of what you're saying is that there is immense power with these private organizations, and that's obviously the case. How does that power get taken from them?
I think you see a lot of signs of the fall right now, and here in 2026, in the wake of this terrible suffering in Europe with this hot summer, and in the U.S. with the degree to which you see all over the country a growing opposition to data centers, some of which is kind of, you know, NIMBYism. People just don't want this big, crazy project in their backyard. But a lot of which seems to be even in some ways less about the data centers per se than about a kind of howl of discontent. Like, I didn't vote for any of this. Like, you're telling me now I have to have a robot in my kitchen and I have to use AI in my job to train it so that it can replace me. Like, my electric bills are going up and we're not building housing in my town, but we're building this giant hyperscale facility to house machines. Like, people are just fed up and furious. And meanwhile, the weather and the climate, I think there's a somewhat disorganized discontent that's about the sense of powerlessness, the sense that, wait, I didn't vote for these guys. I didn't want this stuff. I don't even need these tools. Like, I was doing fine at my job. My job's really meaningful to me. I don't want universal basic income and to sit around and have robot slaves deliver me things. Like, it just feels like a kind of important moment here in 2026 around these issues.
The book is called The Rise and Fall of the Artificial State. Professor Jill Lepore, thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's 11 minutes to 9, and more now on the story we've been covering through the morning on so-called dental deserts. New research by the Nuffield Trust this morning shows that 1 in 10 dental practices in England have stopped providing NHS care since 2017. Well, Dr. Sheena Tanner is the principal dentist at Billericay Dental Care in Essex.
Dentists haven't stopped wanting to treat NHS patients. I think the challenge has been making NHS dentistry sustainable enough for practices to continue providing it. But it is encouraging that the government is looking into it and the changes were made in April and again in June. But I think it's too early to tell you whether those changes have had the impact we want. Across the country, demand is enormous. You know, patients want NHS appointments. And I should say, I think practices do want to provide them. But there's only so much capacity that each practice is allowed.
Mark Diane is the head of public affairs at the Nuffield Trust and co-author of this report that we've been talking about. And he joins us now. Good morning, Mr. Diane.
Good morning.
This is a problem that we've been talking about, that politicians have been talking about for some time now. Is it getting better or is it getting worse?
So our analysis shows that over the last decade, and in fact, particularly in the last 5 years, the problem has really intensified. And it's got to the point now where I think you can no longer say that we have a universal health service if you're trying to include dentistry in that. The biggest drop-off that we see in terms of the practices that are working for the NHS, providing general services, and in terms of people's coverage is during the pandemic. Unfortunately, in the analysis that we've done of practices no longer delivering NHS care, we don't see any recovery in the last year.
And that's interesting because this is something that the new, relatively new government still talked a lot about in opposition and said that they were going to seek to fix in government. But you're saying that so far, at least, that doesn't seem to be having much impact.
They have taken some measures, and there are some measures there that I think we'd really support, like a better level of payment reflects some more complex procedures dentists do. I think the problem is, as our analysis highlights, that this is problem that's been going on really for decades, and it's very deeply rooted dental contract that really doesn't work, and a level of funding that's far too low.
Right, and so this does... Sorry, Mark Diane, there's just some issues on the line, so I'm just going to ask another question. You mentioned there the contract. A lot of this does stem back, doesn't it, to a dental contract that was signed some years ago. Just briefly explain that situation.
That's exactly right. The dental contract is quite simplistic in nature. It pays for very simple bands of different activities that dentists do, and that has several problems. Firstly, it's very unfair across the country. We really showed this in our analysis today. The drop in the number of practices offering general NHS services is much more pronounced in some parts of the country. You look at Devon and Cornwall, for example, 30% of their NHS general practices in dentistry have gone in just 9 years. At the same time, it really doesn't incentivize or encourage dentists to treat those who need it most. Because the payment system is so simplistic, they're actually losing out if they choose patients with the most complex problems or those who need the most preventive care.
And that's why that regional variation is why you warn of a two-tier dentistry system developing, isn't it?
Sadly, we are deep into a two-tier system. At this stage, it's worse in some areas, but it's true for England as a whole. And what that really means is that because there aren't enough dental practices to cover everybody in England, as your guest said earlier, there aren't enough commissioned dental courses of treatment to cover everybody in England. A good proportion of the population aren't seen by NHS dentistry, including most adults, and they have to go private. And if they don't have the money to go private, they face going without care.
And that obviously has serious implications for people's dental health and health more generally.
Absolutely. And we still see that emergency admissions to hospital for tooth decay are up from where they were before the pandemic, which is a really unfortunate situation. In order to turn this around, the government's going to have to go quite a bit further than the measures that it's taken already into really overhauling this contract and either trying to bring it back to a scale where it can cover everyone in England, or at least focusing the care that it does pay for on the people who need it most.
Okay. Mark Diane, Head of Public Affairs at the Nuffield Trust, thank you very much for joining us.
Just to say it's 6 minutes to nine. Coming up on Radio 4, Tristan Redman is going to be joined by journalists and experts who had ringside seats in the biggest moments since the Cold War. This morning he's going to be discussing the rise of populism and America's withdrawal from international agreements. That's in How Did We Get Here? No World Order, coming up at 9:30.
But at 6 minutes to nine, have you ever idly wondered what your mastermind specialist subject would be should you find yourself under the lights in that famous black swivel chair? I know I have. Well, whatever your particular personal fascination, you'd be hard-pressed to out-niche Emily Medhurst, who's gone viral after her appearance last week with the specialist subject Transport for London Maquette. Even the word maquette is niche. So, defined by the London Transport Museum, maquette is the durable woolen seating material that is used in upholstery on public transport all over the world. Let's have a bit of a listen to how Emily got on.
What blue and green check maquette was originally commissioned for the launch of the Victoria line, but because it wasn't ready in time, an existing design was used instead.
Straub.
Yes, the 1940s maquette known as Roundel or Bullseye was originally attributed to Eddie Chapman, but was later discovered to be the work of which other designer?
Joy Jarvis.
It was Joy Jarvis. Emily, you had just a one pass. The artist who created a collage artwork entitled The Fabric of Time, Rita Keegan. So at the end of that round, you've got 8 points.
Well, I'm delighted to say that we are joined now by Emily Medhurst, as well as by Honor Clough, who's a manager for Chimera, which is based in Yorkshire and is a fabric designer and manufacturer for transport, including the Transport for London maquettes. Well, Emily, let's start with you. A really obvious question, I guess. How did you get interested in this?
Hi, thanks so much for having me. I've always been interested in like textiles and design, and growing up in London, I've loved TFL. And I went to an open day at the Acton Depot a few years ago and they had a stand about maquette. And I was like, wow, this is the perfect marriage of like my two interests. So I just got a bit more interested in it then. And when I went on the show, it was a really good opportunity to really like dive into the topic.
So it was about fusing interests in transport and in design, essentially.
Yeah, definitely.
Because I grew up in London too, and I've spent a lot of my life on tube trains. I can't say that I ever did pay much attention to the particular textile design of particular seats. I think you must have. Do you remember a particular stage when you suddenly thought, oh, it's really interesting how the Bakerloo line has slightly different fabric to the Piccadilly line? Or was it more of a sort of slow blossoming interest?
I think it was a bit of a slow blossoming interest. And I think it's like once you realise it's there, you realise how much unique design there is across the network in the seats and like in the posters and everything. And it's really fun to kind of see the variation across the whole network.
And what those who haven't watched your episode of Mastermind won't know is that you were wearing a vest inspired by the London Overground maquette while you were in the chair being grilled by Clive Murray. That's right, isn't it?
Yes, that was my number one priority when I got told I was going to be on the show, was to knit something to wear.
Oh, you made it yourself?
Yes. So, I took precedent over the revision a little bit, but I made it myself.
Okay, well, you may well then be giving our next guest, Honor Clough, from Chimera a run for her money, because Chimera actually make these maquettes. Honor Clough, what goes into the process of designing and manufacturing these maquettes?
Hi, thank you for having me on today. So a lot of time and effort obviously goes into the design work, and you've always got to think about how it's going to look whilst it's on, obviously, on public transport. You've got to think about hiding those sins, you know, things like dirt and things like that. But also with TFL, they always pay homage to something, so the surroundings, so it might be the buildings. The Elizabeth line, for example, they chose the royal purple to celebrate the Queen. So there's always little things that you can notice within the designs that bring out the brand or the area that the fabric's on.
Do you have a particular favourite design that you've been involved in?
I mean, there's lots and lots.
Sorry, I've put you on the spot there. Oh, go on, you were going to tell us.
Yeah, I mean, I can't just pick one. Obviously, we do lots worldwide. It's always nice to see them eventually in situ. Obviously, the Piccadilly lines due for coming up with the new tube, so I'm excited to see that when it finally gets on the tracks.
Well, Emily Medhurst, you heard from Honor Clough there that they do lots of maquettes worldwide, so presumably you're going to go back on Mastermind next year and do another transport systems maquettes with your own new knitted jumper.
Yeah, I think, maybe an excuse to knit something new, I think.
And just very finally, very briefly, we don't have foreboding music.